This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network, which includes the Erotica Podcast, Erotica Sci-Fi and Fantasy, Erotica Loving Wives, and the Spotify podcast Erotica Taboo Podcast for more intense sexual themes. Both the Erotica Podcast and the Erotica Taboo Podcast offer $2 subscriptions, which opens up bonus content. Links for everything are in the podcast description. This podcast contains mature content and is intended for an adult audience only. It contains explicit words, thoughts, and ideas. The content of all stories is fiction, with any similarities to real people or events being purely coincidental. This podcast is not intended for anything but entertainment of the listener, and if you do not agree with the themes listed in the tags, please do not listen to the story. All characters engaging in sexual relationships or activities are 18 years old or older. This story was found on a free website and brought to audio form here. I did not write and take no credit for this story. Please visit the link in the comments to further support this author. Hate at First Sight by Black Randall, 1958. Do you believe in hate at first sight? If you believe in love at first sight, can the opposite also happen? I hated Talbot McCoy the first time I saw him. It wasn't that he was ugly or weird, quite the contrary. He was tall, well-built, and I would discover, very smart, too. He had tons of curly dark hair, a face off a fashion magazine, and all the other kids at school loved him. I hated him. My name is Livingston Brooks. Don't call me Livy either. I hate that name. I seem to start out here hating a lot of things. I'm really not like that. Just as many people loved me as loved Talbot. I'm a bit like him in a lot of ways. I'm tall, athletic, and smarter than he is. The biggest difference between us is that I'm black and he's white. That doesn't matter to me. There were only 9 black kids in our high school and I didn't care for most of them. A white family adopted me when I was little and I love my parents. I just point that out as a matter of fact, not to indicate that I hated him because he was white. I moved to the school I was attending between my sophomore and junior years. I was number 1 in my class at my old school. When I got to the new school, I was number 2. You guessed it, Talbot was number 1. What pissed me off was that he never worked at it. He took blow-off classes and aced them. It didn't hurt that all the teachers loved him. Hell, my mom and dad loved him. My mom was a science teacher and my dad was the football coach and taught health and PE. I took dual credit, college and high school, classes, and I worked my butt off to get those grades. Talbot played defensive end on dad's football team and he was All-State 3 years in a row. I played volleyball and ran track. Talbot did track too, but he threw discus. I was out there running my ass off trying to break the school record in the 400 meters. He would be leaning against the fence. He'd push off every now and again, go throw 3 or 4 times, and then hold that fence up again for a while. What made it so infuriating was that he once stayed our junior and senior years. So did I, but I busted my ass and he goofed off. By taking those weighted classes, I passed him in the class rankings. He never seemed to mind. He was always happy and cheerful. He talked to me every day. I had him 3rd hour in Art 3 my junior year, and when I walked in the first day he introduced himself and hugged me. He hugged me every day for 2 years. It wasn't special, he hugged everyone. He'd be going down the hall and everyone he hadn't seen yet that day would stop for one of those hugs until he'd be late for class. The teachers never counted him tardy. We had the same conditioning class 1st hour our senior year. He was 10 minutes late on the days he bothered to show up at all. Dad taught that class and he never counted him tardy or absent. When I told Dad I wanted to sleep in and miss his class, I got this lecture about responsibility and being the best I could be. When I mentioned Talbot, he got this huge silly grin on his face.
Talbot is just special, he said.
What about me? I asked.
I'm your daughter. Aren't I special?
He snatched me up and squeezed me until I could hardly breathe.
Of course you are, honey. You're my baby girl. Your butt is getting fat, though, so you need the conditioning.
Beating on him with my fists didn't faze him a bit. He just spanked me on my fat butt and kissed me. My butt isn't really fat. Fat, maybe, but not fat. I have one of those sprinter butts and guys can't keep their eyes off it. It's hard and round and I work on it a lot. Dad knows that and he loves to tease me about it. Our senior year, I decided to run for student council president. Guess who was running against me? I was eating lunch, and Talbot came and sat down beside me. He hugged me, of course.
Livy, he said. I don't want to run against you.
Of course, he would call me that.
I know you'll beat me. You're the class president and more people like you than like me.
Do you want to be both things?
I thought about it.
No, I don't really have time to be both. Talbot, how many times have I told you not to call me Livy?
I'm sorry, he said.
I always forget. I just call people nicknames. Think about this. You decide which one you want. If you want to be student council president, I'll drop out and run for class president. If you want to be class president, you drop out and run for that.
I wanted both just to rub his nose in it, but I'm not stupid. I doubted more people like me than him anyway.
Okay, I said. I'll drop out of the class president race. You take that.
He hugged me again.
Good choice, he said. You'll be a better student council president than me anyway.
Stop that, I told him.
Why do you always do that? We aren't friends, Talbot. Stop being so nice to me, and stop hugging me.
I told him that 1,000 times and he never paid the slightest attention to me. He just laughed.
I'm wearing you down, he said. Someday you'll admit that you're in love with me.
He talked to me all the rest of lunch hour, and the next morning he actually showed up for conditioning.
The first thing he did was hug me. He was infuriating. When we graduated, we both made speeches and he actually thanked me for pushing him to be better. He said I had been a wonderful inspiration to him because of my work ethic and he admired me. It nearly made me puke. We wound up at the same university, and he made it a point to talk to me every day. It was the same old hugging routine, and people actually thought he was my boyfriend. No one would ask me out because they thought I was with Talbot. Since we were on the track team together, he made it a point to sit by me on the buses or airplanes, and it seemed like I couldn't get away from him. He was such a nice guy that I couldn't be mean enough to him to drive him away, and it just got worse and worse. I had thought that high school was bad enough, but college was even worse. People would invite me to parties by asking if Talbot and I were doing anything Friday. I would tell them I had no idea what Talbot was doing, but I'd be happy to come to the party. They would look at me as if I was weird and ask me if we had broken up. It just wasn't worth it to straighten them out. He would even ask me things like, "Hey, Calvin asked if we were going to the lake with him, are we?" I got so sick of it that I stopped going anywhere. My roommate thought something was wrong with me. "Are you sick, Livingston?" she asked me one evening. "No, I'm fine." I shot at her. "Leave me the hell alone." "Jesus, girlfriend, I was just asking," she said. "I'm worried about you." "I'm sorry, Allie, I didn't mean to snap at you," I said. "You need to relax," she said. "There's a party at the Wilsons. Let's go." I grumbled around a while, but she dragged me off to the party. I actually had a good time and there was no sign of Talbot. I smoked a couple of joints, it's legal here, and had way too much to drink. The next thing I knew, I was away from the lights, fighting off two douchebags from the baseball team who were trying to get me naked. "Come on, baby, you know you want it," one of them kept telling me. I managed to get one leg free and I made a mess of his nuts with my knee. He screeched like a banshee and that pissed the other one off. He slapped the shit out of me and my head was spinning. I heard a kind of roar, and when I could see straight, I saw Talbot, mounted on top of the one that hit me, and he was turning the asshole's face into mush. "I'm going to kill you, you motherfucker," he was screaming over and over. "You hit her, you son of a bitch. No one touches Livy." He was driving one fist after another into the guy's face. I was scared to death, and I ran over and tackled Talbot off the guy. "Please, Talbot," I begged. "Don't kill him. Don't hit him anymore. Take me home, please, Talbot." He had kind of a wild look in his eyes that faded when he saw who it was. Of course, he jumped up and hugged me. He tilted my face up so he could look at it. "Are you okay, Livy? I saw that asshole hit you. I just got here and I didn't know you were coming." "I'm okay, Talbot, just take me home. Stop calling me Livy," I begged. He had ridden his motorcycle, and I had to make him stop once on the way back to my apartment so I could puke. He held my head while I heaved my guts up, and cleaned me up with his handkerchief. I mean, who carries a handkerchief these days? I don't remember going into the apartment, or getting in bed. I woke up the next morning and my mouth felt like rats had taken up residence in it. There was a trio of blacksmiths banging away on anvils inside my head, and I felt like fried shit. I could smell bacon and Talbot stuck his head in. "Hi, Livy." He was all smiles. "Get that cute little black ass out of bed and come and eat breakfast," I moaned. "Talbot, you are the bane of my existence. What are you doing here?" I didn't wait for an answer. I needed to puke. I jumped out of bed and made a run for the stool. I shrieked when I realized I was in my bra and panties, and they were really small panties. I made my offering to the porcelain gods, and there was Talbot with a cool wet washcloth, cleaning me up. "Damn, Livy," he said. "You were really messed up. I've never seen you like that before." He picked me up and carried me like a baby back to bed. I was too weak and too sick to protest. He covered me up and went away. I just laid there and suffered. He came back with a bottle of water and 4 ibuprofens. I was very glad to have them. I drank the whole bottle of water, took the pills, and collapsed back on the bed. "What are you doing here, Talbot?" I asked him again. "Did you take my clothes off? If you grope me, I'm going to kill you," he grinned. "I was afraid to leave you. You were messed up bad, Livy. Your clothes had puke on them, so I took them off and put you in bed. I kept checking on you. I didn't grope you, but I wanted to. You're pretty gropeable. I'm bringing you your breakfast." I didn't want breakfast. I just wanted to die in peace, preferably, somewhere far away from him. He brought back a plate with scrambled eggs and bacon on it, and a glass of milk. I didn't want it, but he fed the eggs to me, anyway. By the time I finished them, I was feeling better and I ate the bacon, too. It was salty and I was very thirsty, so I drank the milk. "Why did you go to that party without me?" he asked. "You know I would have taken you, and I wouldn't have allowed you to get that high. Jesus Christ, Talbot," I exploded. "Why do you do this to me? You know I don't like you. You're not my boyfriend. Why can't you just leave me alone?" He looked very hurt, and I was instantly sorry. I wasn't about to tell him that. "That's something I've never been able to figure out, Livy," he said. "Why don't you like me? You're as sweet as an angel. You love everyone. You're even nice to me and I bug you all the time. Why don't you like me? For one thing, you insist on calling me Livy and you know I hate it," I yelled. He grinned. "I just do it to pull your chain," he said. "Well, it pisses me off," I told him. "You're just too perfect, Talbot. Everything about you is just perfect and that pisses me off, too. You just slide along. You never put any effort into anything and everything you touch turns to gold. You just affect me like nails on a chalkboard. Why won't you leave me alone?
Too perfect? Talbot sort of snorted. Does it help if I brush my hair backwards?
He ran a hand through his mop of curls.
It made no difference whatsoever.
Nope, that doesn't change a thing. You're still too perfect. You're the one who's perfect, Livy.
I mean, Livingston. Have you looked at yourself lately?
Well, maybe not this morning, but how about yesterday? You're the sweetest person I know, at least when you're not around me, and the smartest.
Don't you get it yet?
I'm trying to keep up with you.
I looked at him, expecting to have my headache made even worse by his blinding smile. Instead, he was looking at me seriously, puzzled and a little exasperated. Maybe if I pushed him now, he really would leave me alone.
Go tell it to the Marines, Talbot.
I snorted.
I have to work damned hard for every grade I get, and for the shape this body is in. I have to work hardest of all to be nice enough to you to keep up my sweet reputation.
You just sit there, not having to work at a thing.
You were born perfect, Talbot. You live perfect, and you'll die perfect, and you do it all without even breaking a sweat.
Worst of all, now I owe you for last night.
You make me sick.
No, that was the booze you put away last night.
He grinned.
Don't try to be funny, Talbot. This isn't the time.
Okay then.
If you hate me so much, why do you talk about me as if I were Jesus?
My mouth fell open.
I couldn't say a word.
Because he's the only one I've ever heard of who's that perfect.
You don't hate him, do you?
I still couldn't speak, so I just shook my head.
Then why do you hate me?
Would you like me better if I treated you like those two assholes did last night, so I wouldn't be perfect anymore? I don't think you really want a guy to bash you over the head with a club and drag you back to his cave, and I'm not really made like that, but if that's what you want, I'll try.
Would that make me less perfect? Or would that make me even more perfect?
I've tried doing one thing to be less perfect, like calling you Livy, and that doesn't work either, because you still think I'm perfect. How can I be perfect if I call you by a name you hate? Am I trying too hard not to be perfect and ending up being perfect? Does perfect mean what I think it means?
He heaved an exasperated sigh and ran a hand through his hair. It didn't make any difference, it was still perfect.
You do realize, don't you, that all of this is total nonsense, and now you have me doing it too?
He looked as if he'd just been told the sun would rise in the west tomorrow, and he just couldn't handle it, and was asking me to make it all better. Okay, I did feel just a little bit sorry for him just then. It was probably my weakened condition, and the fact that I did owe him for last night.
Don't get me wrong, though, I still hated him.
Talbot, I know it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense to me, so I don't know why it would to you.
You know what Mark Twain said, we don't reason where we feel, we just feel.
All I know is, every time I'm around you, I just want to scream and run the other way. You make me angrier than anyone or anything else I know.
I don't know why, and I've never felt that way about anyone else in my life.
He got that hurt look again.
I know that isn't what you wanted to hear, but it's true.
For some reason, you're just, like nails on a chalkboard to me.
So thank you for last night, but please, Talbot, please just leave me alone.
He got serious.
I can't, Livingston.
Why the hell not?
I asked. He smiled and those white teeth flashed.
Because I love you.
He said. My mouth fell open and I just sat there dumbfounded.
I shook my head.
I couldn't have heard that right.
What did you just say?
I asked.
I said I love you.
He repeated.
Jesus H. Christ.
I blew up.
Of all the stupid things anyone has ever said to me.
I didn't get a chance to finish because he was kissing me. I was totally mortified, indignant and pissed off beyond belief. I struggled to get away, but he was way stronger than me. My lips felt like they were being bruised, and he smelled really nice. I could feel the muscles flexing in his arms and shoulders beneath my fingers. That big mop of curly hair was fascinating, and I just had to tangle my fingers in it. My heart was pounding, and I felt his hand on the bare skin of my belly. I needed to gasp, but he had my mouth.
I panted a little through my nose, and his fingers trailed fire up to my right breast. For some reason, my nipple was as hard as a little pebble, and he pinched it, rolling it between his fingers.
I reacted, involuntarily arching my back so he would take the whole mound into his hand while he played with the nipple.
He pushed my bra up over it, and suddenly he shifted until he could take the other nipple between his lips. He scraped it gently with his teeth and it made me groan. My pussy flooded and I was losing control.
No,
I said.
Stop, Talbot. Stop it.
I was insistent and he stopped and looked up at me.
You don't like it?
He asked.
Yes, I do, and that's the problem.
I told him.
I'm not doing this with you, Talbot. Put my bra back down.
He did, and then he took me in his arms and just held me, his fingers tracing up and down the bare skin of my back, giving me goosebumps.
Thank you for what you did last night.
I told him.
What did you mean, nobody touches Livy?
He blushed.
I should have said Livingston.
He apologized.
That's not what I was talking about.
I said.
Why can't anyone touch me?
You didn't want them to.
He said.
You were fighting them.
You messed Alex up pretty bad. He's in the hospital having his nuts treated.
He chuckled.
You're quite a tiger, Livy.
He was immediately contrite.
I meant Livingston. Why do you have a boy's name?
That's what my parents named me.
I said. Do you envision yourself as my guardian angel, Talbot? I'm not going to let anyone hurt you or make you do anything you don't want to.
He said.
If you hadn't been fighting them, I wouldn't have interfered. It would have broken my heart, but I'd have just walked away.
I kissed his lips, just a quick peck. Thank you for looking out for me, I said. I want to do way more than that. He looked into my eyes. I can't imagine why, I said. I've never been anything more than civil to you, Talbot. I've never given you the slightest hint that I thought you were anything but an asshole. He laughed. I know. Do you know that you're the only girl I ever wanted that couldn't stand the sight of me? I've never been turned down for a date unless the girl was already involved and I didn't know it. I've loved you from the first day you moved here and you've never given me anything but drop dead, asshole. I've never been an asshole to you, though. I know, it's just me, I said. I know you're a great guy, Talbot. Half the girls here get wet panties every time you walk by. Why don't you go after one of them? Because I'm in love with this fantastic little black girl, he said. She has this hair that looks like mine except it's about a foot longer, these huge eyes that just drown me every time I look in them, the most luscious lips imaginable, the most incredibly firm tits I've ever seen, an ass that makes me weak in the knees and legs that are just spectacular. Please spare my blushes, I told him. It's me, remember? I look in the mirror every day. That's what I love most about you, he said. You have no idea how incredibly hot you are. I snorted. Thanks for the flattery, I said. Now I want you to go home, Talbot. I'm going to sleep for about 24 hours. When I wake up, we're going to forget all about these 2 days. Things are going to go back to the way they were before. No, they're not. You're going to stop tormenting me. I don't mind seeing you around a couple of times a week, but you get on my nerves any more than that. Do you understand? He grinned. Sorry, no can do. I'm going to remember everything. I'm going to remember exactly how those little chocolate nipples taste and how firm your ass is under my fingers. I'm going to remember everything. And I'm going to see you every day. I love you and I can't stay away. I'm going to tell the campus police you're stalking me, I told him. Okay, he said. Do you think they'll arrest me? I don't want them to arrest you. I just want you to leave me alone, I told him. He didn't and I didn't tell the police. I transferred at semester. I told the coach I had a problem with my boyfriend and I couldn't attend that school anymore. He released me from my commitment, and I didn't have to sit out a year for track. I got an even better scholarship, and I absolutely forbade Dad and Mom from telling anyone where I was. And why life gradually reached some semblance of sanity. I went on dates like normal girls, I went to parties, and I went to school. I didn't go home for 6 years. Dad and Mom came to see me and I missed the hell out of them. After I graduated, I was accepted into law school at SMU. I passed the bar and got a job offer back in Portland. I was a criminal defense attorney. I'd done internships in the prosecutor's office in Fort Worth and Dallas, and I hated everything about it and everyone that worked there. What kind of people persecute others for a living? Yes, I said persecute. They were corrupt, self-aggrandizing, politically upwardly mobile, full of self-importance, and did I mention corrupt? I heard that at law school before I took the internships. The only people that went into prosecution were would-be politicians and the incompetent, people that couldn't make it in private practice. No, I wanted to make sure people that were on the wrong side of the political spectrum got a fair shake. They wanted me bad at my firm, and they gave me a pretty sweet deal. My first case was defending a teacher accused of molesting the little girls in his second grade class. Some fat ugly skank in social services got carried away. Her methods were outlandish, and she coerced tales out of those kids that were impossible. I mean, they were anatomically impossible. There was not a shred of physical evidence. It all rested on the testimony of second grade children. We got independent experts to examine the children, and they all confessed that they made the stories up to keep the skank off their case. As long as they made her happy, she left them alone. If they tried to tell the truth, she threatened them. When I showed up in court, who do you think the assistant district attorney was? It was none other than Talbot McCoy. My instincts were right. No wonder I hated him. He called all his witnesses, played ridiculous videos and put the skank on the stand. In the meantime, the good man, the dedicated teacher who had spent a year in jail, lost his wife, been denied the right to see his kids and had his life ruined, sat by me and sobbed. I took the skank apart. She was blubbering on the stand about being molested by a teacher when she was 6, and repressed memories, by the time I got through with her. A jury of 12 of his peers declared him not guilty after 2 hours. Talbot came over to congratulate me after the show was over and, of course, the first thing he did was hug me. God, you look good, Livingston, he said. Where have you been? I looked everywhere for you. Your parents wouldn't tell me where you were. Did you know I'm volunteering for your dad as an assistant coach? Damn, I've missed you. Would you like to go to dinner and catch up? No, Talbot, I wouldn't, I said. You have the nerve to come over here and ask me to have dinner with you after what you just tried to do to my client? The man was obviously not guilty and you and that fat bitch tried to railroad him. He looked like his feelings were hurt. I don't get to pick my cases, he said. If the DA gives me a case, I have to make the best of it. I'm just doing my job, Livingston. Well, your job sucks, I told him. Do you realize you just gave me the same excuse the Nazi prison guards gave for slaughtering people? Don't speak to me outside professional bounds again. You need a new job, Talbot. Are you thinking about running for office? I could tell by the embarrassed look on his face that he was. I was disgusted. Jesus Christ, Talbot, what happened to you? I walked away and left him standing there. The next day we filed suit against the county, social services, and the skank. They were very sorry and offered to settle. My client wanted it to all just go away. I didn't think that was in his best interests. I wanted the skank's license pulled, her public humiliation, a wrongful imprisonment against the county, a malicious prosecution against social services and the DA's office, and a huge cash settlement. They amended their offer several times. Finally, my client took it against my advice. I got him everything but the DA's office. 3 weeks later, I went to dinner at Mom's and Talbot was sitting at the table when I walked in. I started out the door and Mom ran after me. She threw herself on me and begged me to stay. "I'm sorry, baby." She was crying. "Your father and I love Talbot. He told us he had something he needed to say to you and you blocked his calls and refused to speak to him. I'll make him leave if you want me to. We'll never see him again. I'll make your father fire him. Don't shut us out, honey, please." I held her tightly. "That will never happen, Mom. I owe you my life. You took me in off the streets and I'll love you and Dad forever. He makes me crazy, Mom. I think he is crazy. What could he possibly have to say to me?" "I don't know, honey. He wouldn't say." She hugged me and wiped the tears that were running down her cheeks. "Maybe you should just let him have his say. I'll make him leave right after dinner." I kissed her on both eyes. My lips were wet with her tears and I kissed her lips. "Don't cry, Mom. I'm sorry I made you cry. Don't break my heart." She held me very tightly. "It's your dad and me that owe you everything," she said. "You know we couldn't have children. Then we got you and our lives were complete. You made us happy, Livingston. You're my heart." We were both crying now, and it took us a minute to compose ourselves. Dad came looking for us and found us leaning against my car and blubbering. He came and held us and we straightened ourselves and went in. Talbot, of course, gave me a hug, and we started eating. Conversation was all football for a while, but Talbot kept glancing at me. Finally, Mom threw up her hands. "For heaven's sake, Talbot, spit it out." He cleared his throat a time or two. "Livingston, you were right," he said. "You were right about everything. I thought about what you said about the Nazi death camp guards. I can't imagine what could have happened to me to cause me to make that statement. As I thought, I realized I didn't like myself very much. At first, I was furious at you. The more I thought about it, the angrier I got. Then I figured out that it wasn't you I was angry with, it was me. I don't know what happened to me. That was exactly what the Nazi death camp guard said. I was just doing my job. I had a talk with your father and I quit the DA's office 3 days after you said those things to me. Thank God you got that man acquitted. I don't know how I'd live with myself if I had won that case. That's what I wanted to tell you. What about politics?" I asked. "What are you going to do?" "I joined the public defender's office." He grinned ruefully and that playful boy that I'd always known was back. "I need some experience before I hang out my shingle. I'm going to get it right this time." Damn, now I was going to have to treat him decently again. "Okay, that's good. I'm proud of you," I told him. "I'm sorry, Livingston. Do you forgive me? You didn't do anything to me," I said. "It's yourself you were killing." "Yes, I forgive you. Does that mean you'll have dinner with me?" He looked hopeful. "Jesus Christ, Talbot, give it a rest," I told him. "I still don't like you." "I can't." He was grinning at me. "Wipe that stupid grin off your face," I told him. "What the hell do you mean you can't? I'd kind of like to know that myself," Dad said. "Coach, I'm in love with your daughter," Talbot said. "I have been since we were juniors in high school. She hates me, but I can't help it. I'm crazy about her." "See, Mom, I told you," I said. "No, I don't see," she retorted. "Why do you hate Talbot?" "He annoys me," I said. "He's a supercilious bastard and he always has been." "No, he's not," Dad said. "This has something to do with you, Liv. Are you not telling us something? What is this, an inquisition?" I asked. "I'm defending myself in my own home to my own parents?" "No, no, of course not," Mom said. "If you don't want to talk about it, we won't. You men are going to leave Livingston alone." They knew better than to argue with Mom. We had dessert, and we played party games for a couple of hours. It was a hoot, and I had a good time. When I got up to go, Talbot got up too. He walked me to my car and opened the door for me. He knelt in the door with his eyes level with mine. "I'm not going to give up, Livy," he said. "Have dinner with me." I laughed. "You're a persistent son of a bitch, Talbot. I'll think about it. Don't pester me, I mean it. It just pisses me off." "I won't," he promised. "You better tell me soon, though, or it will have to be McDonald's. We public defenders aren't highly compensated." I laughed. "I think you're going to be just fine. You'll hit the ground running. You've succeeded at everything you've ever done. State champ, remember?" "Yeah, you're right," he said. "I'm the champ." "So are you, Livy." "Thanks. I'm glad you aren't married." "How do you know I'm not?" I asked. His eyes fell to my hand and didn't see a ring. I laughed. "Got you there," he chuckled. "Call me," he said, and he shut the door. I drove home and forgot about it. I was very busy for the next 3 weeks, and I never gave Talbot McCoy a thought. I was in a meeting with an assistant DA and she was very short with me. I asked the guy that was with me what had her panties in a bunch and he said it was probably she had heard Talbot was crazy about me and she had designs on him herself. I texted him and told him I'd meet him for dinner if he'd let me by. He called after 10 minutes. We agreed on the place and I told him I'd meet him there. "Christ, Livingston, give me a chance here," he said. "Let me pick you up and take you on a date. Let me take you out for a drink and a dance afterward. I haven't danced with you since we were prom king and queen. It didn't kill you then, and it won't kill you now. I had to laugh. Okay, Talbot, you can pick me up. I gave him the address and forgot about it. I didn't forget Friday, and I was ready to go. The traditional little black dress doesn't do that much for us dusky maidens, but a white one really makes my complexion pop. Talbot's eyes nearly fell out of his head, and he croaked something at me. It was very amusing.
Close your mouth. I said. You look like a fool. He grinned.
I feel like a fool. He said. I don't know why I do this to myself. I must be a masochist. I figured that out a long time ago. I told him. We're a perfect match, because I'm a sadist. No, I know better than that. He said.
You're perfect, Livy. You've always been perfect.
Talbot. I warned him. If you call me Livy one more time, I'm going back in and you can go eat at McDonald's by yourself. He laughed.
Sorry about that. I keep forgetting. I'll try really hard.
I liked his car. It was an old MG, in perfect shape, and I thought it would be fun to drive. We drove about 5 minutes and he pulled into McDonald's and parked. I just looked at him. It was my turn to look like a fool with my mouth open. He burst out laughing and nearly choked.
You should see the look on your face.
He wheezed.
You really thought I was taking you to McDonald's, didn't you?
The man was infuriating.
Okay, ha ha. I said.
Very funny, Talbot. Where are you taking me?
Only high class for my girl. He said. We're going to Wendy's.
That set him off again. He wiped his eyes with his handkerchief. Who has a handkerchief these days? Then I remembered. Talbot always carried a handkerchief.
That was what he had cleaned me up with that night when he rescued me when I was puking my guts out. I remembered what had happened the next morning, too.
Talbot, did I ever thank you for rescuing me that night I got so wasted at the party? I asked him.
Yeah.
He gave me that boyish grin. You kissed me and let me feel you up, remember?
I blushed furiously.
Yes, black people can blush. You asshole. I half yelled. You practically raped me. I've been traumatized ever since. Where are we eating? I'm starving.
Someplace with a salad bar. He said.
Your dad told me your butt is getting fat and you're worried about it.
I hated him. I hated my dad, too. He was going to catch hell for this.
Well, you and dad can both kiss my fat ass. I told him. I want fish and pasta. Get moving.
He took me to Joe's, and it was very good. I was having a good time, too, in spite of being in the company of a creature I hated. He was as witty and charming as ever, smoking hot too. Those big brown eyes, all that hair, those huge muscles, and still as smart as ever. He told me about how work at the public defender's office was going. He was defending homeless people, drug addicts, and immigrants. He thought it was very rewarding and he was feeling very good about himself. I was happy for him and very gratified that he was enjoying his position, especially since I had made it impossible for him to stay in the persecutor's office and live with himself. He took me to a club and we had a great time. That is, until we ran into some asshole that had a problem with us.
What's a fine sister like you doing with white bread here? He asked.
Let's you and me get out on the floor, bust some moves in La Marte and make you forget all about white boy.
Drop dead, asshole.
I told him. I turned back to Talbot.
Want to dance? I asked him. We haven't danced since high school prom.
Yeah, I know. He said.
I'm talking to you, bitch.
La Marte was still alive. I had told him to drop dead. He hadn't listened. That was a mistake. I stood up.
Well, since you're such a dominant, intelligent man, how can I say no to that? I said.
You brothers sure know how to talk to a sister and get her all hot and bothered. He smiled like a fool, oblivious to my sarcasm, and took me by the elbow, pulling me up against him. I used the momentum and kneed him in the balls with everything I had. My father is a football coach, and I've been lifting weights every day since I was 12. La Martin was going to need help. I held out my hand to Talbot, and he took it with a grin.
I've seen that move before.
He said. We stepped over La Martin and moved to the dance floor.
I don't think we should go back to that booth. He said, nodding in that direction.
There were a couple of bouncers dragging La Martin off, and a third one looking around, trying to spot whoever was responsible for La Martin's condition. I ducked my head into Talbot's chest and giggled.
God, you're sexy, Liv.
Livingston, he said.
You have the cutest giggle. I've always loved it. Why didn't you knee me in the balls that morning I practically raped you? I was off my game.
I grinned up at him.
I was hungover badly, remember? Besides, you made me breakfast. I'd like to make you breakfast again, he said.
Spend the night with me and I will.
Are you nuts?
I couldn't believe he said that.
Jesus Christ, Talbot, just when I was beginning to think you got it.
He looked shocked.
Got what? What's wrong? I just told you I'd like to have you spend the night. Why would I want to spend the night with someone I can just barely tolerate? I said. You may have weaseled your way into mom and dad's hearts, but not mine.
I think that finally pissed him off.
I don't need this.
He practically dragged me back to our table.
I've never been anything but nice to you, Livingston. For some reason, you've hated me since the minute you set eyes on me.
I've tried and tried, I've hung around for years, treating you like a princess, and your feelings about me haven't changed a bit.
Well, I've had enough.
I thought you would have grown up by now, but no. You're still the same spoiled little brat you've always been. If you're through with your drink, I'm taking you home.
Well, he was finally waking up. It was about time. I signaled to the waiter, and he brought our check. I left a tip and Talbot settled up. Our drive home was silent and hostile. That suited me just fine. When he pulled up at my apartment, he didn't even get out, and that suited me, too. I went in and answered some emails, took a bath, and went to bed. The next Monday at work, Thomas Beck asked me out for Saturday. I liked him, but I turned him down a dozen times. I was feeling differently now. I said yes, and I felt pretty good about it. He was an up-and-comer and seemed like a nice guy. He was a little arrogant and brash, but he had some reason. He did tax law and wasn't really a courtroom kind of guy, but there are probably more billable hours in that than anything else. I knew he was getting close to junior partner and I wanted that too. I figured I was a lock after the publicity with the schoolteacher case. The senior partners had been making a point out of coming by to congratulate me. Saturday rolled around and I was feeling pretty good. I worked out, had a light lunch and I was ready for the big date. It was a bit of a disappointment. Dinner and a movie, sort of uninspiring. I had a good time though, and I kissed Thomas goodnight, thinking I might have something going on. I hadn't been dating much, concentrating on my education first, and then later, on getting my career off to a good start. This felt pretty good and I agreed to a second date. That was a nightmare. We went to a club, he had too much to drink and turned into Mr. Octopus Arms. For some reason, he felt like it would be a great idea for him to put his hands all over me. It wasn't a very good idea. I suppose he thought I should be impressed with his greatness and be grateful that he wanted to maul my breasts. I do enjoy a good mauling every now and again, but only from people I invite to the party. I reached over and stroked the front of his pants. He had an impressive hard-on. I slid the zipper down and reached in. He had a disgusting smirk on his face. "You like that big dick, don't you, baby?" he growled. "Oh, yeah," I said. "Let me get that out for you, baby." When I did, I twisted it up like a dish rag and dug my nails in. He tried to jump up, but the table was in the way. "What the hell is wrong with you?" he yelled. "Touch my tits again and I'll rip it off," I told him. I stood up and walked out. I got a cab and went home. I got some funny looks at work that Monday, but no one said anything about it. I went on 5 more dates that month and they were all disasters. On the last one, we went to a jazz concert and I was trying to listen to the music while the idiot I was with was speaking into my ear, telling me all about how great he was. I looked across the room and I saw a huge guy with a big mop of dark curly hair sitting over there. There was some blonde bimbo with fake tits and a nose job hanging all over him. I was a little taken aback. It was Talbot McCoy. My heart started to beat faster and I started getting angry. I had no idea why, but this didn't feel right. He could do better than that. She was superficially pretty, yes, but anyone vain enough to do what she'd obviously done to herself had to be some kind of narcissist. I pulled my idiot up. "Let's dance," I said. He was happy to get a chance and I realized that I could do better too. Suddenly it hit me. I was jealous. Here I was, dancing with an asshole, and sitting across the room was a great guy that had been crazy about me for years. I had been a bitch to him for years and now he was moving on with that blonde skank. I started feeling kind of panicky. I had to go over there. I left my date standing there on the dance floor and walked over to where Talbot was sitting. "Hi, Talbot." I tapped him on the shoulder. He started and looked up. When he saw me, his face lit up with that big smile, but then it sort of faded. "Hi, Livingston," he said. "What are you doing here?" "I'm on a date," I said. I introduced him to the non-entity who had followed me over. "Talbot and I have been friends since high school," I told our dates. Talbot looked a little confused. "We have?" he asked. "Oh, well, yeah, Liv. Livingston's dad was my high school football coach." "Nice save," I thought. "Mind if we join you?" I asked. The bimbo, obviously, wanted no part of me, but she didn't have a choice. Talbot looked a little reluctant, but he displayed his usual gracious gentility. He stood up while I slid in, followed by my vacuous date. I compared the two men in my head and I began to get a little clarity. Here was Talbot. He was hotter than hell, smart as a whip, and probably the most athletic big man I'd ever seen. Then, there was my date. Successful, yes he was. Driven, and so in love with himself he made Narcissus look emo. He was an empty shell of a man, and I was his counterpart. No, I didn't have his devotion to self-worship, but I was just as driven and missing something vital in my soul. Talbot and I monopolized the conversation, reminiscing about old times, high school triumphs and defeats, and our dates grew increasingly bored. I finally took pity on them. I made my excuses and kissing Talbot on the cheek, we left. I told Talbot to call me and he promised he would. He lied. The bastard lied. I waited 2 weeks and never heard a peep. Now I remembered all the reasons I hated him and I was moving on. I didn't. I dated and I partied and I worked my little ass off, but I thought about Talbot about once a week for 9 months. I never saw him, and no one even mentioned his name once. I thought I would probably see him in court, but since the schoolteacher case, I was getting some cases that were pretty plumb. I was assisting on some very high-profile cases and you don't see public defenders much on those types of cases. The dirtbags I was defending had money. Public defenders are usually either fresh out of law school, washouts from firms, or just people who don't know what they're doing. When you cannot afford an attorney and one is provided for you, you don't get the cream of the crop. Even a very good public defender loses about 80% of the cases she tries. In that environment, I was sure Talbot would shine like a star and rise like a rocket. Sure enough, it wasn't long before he was getting cases that made the news, and winning more than his fair share of them.
Of course, his perfect looks and charisma didn't hurt, I thought. Well, I had all that, too, and we would just see. Several of the partners had made it a point to come by my office now and again and talk to me after I won the schoolteacher case. One morning, one of them pointed out an article in the newspaper to me. "That young man is in a spot of trouble," he told me, pointing to a picture on an inside page. The man in the picture was indicted for several counts of drug trafficking, various kinds of assault, and some money laundering as well. Our firm had gotten him off from similar charges about a year before. Rumor had it that the money we were paid with was somewhat tainted, but there was never any real evidence. The fact that he has a PD this time instead of our jolly group of knights-errant makes me think that his, employers seem to be throwing him under the bus. Making him take one for the team, as it were. I'm afraid he's in for it. There's just no honor among thieves. He shook his head and made a TSK sound. Who's defending him? I like to keep current with the criminal law practice in town. Let me see. He consulted the paper. Ah, McCoy. It seems someone over there doesn't like how fast he's rising. This will slow him down for a while. He smiled, I smiled, and he left. The same partner stopped by a few weeks later. He'd made a habit of stopping in from time to time. He wanted to check out my tits and look at my legs. I wanted his vote when I was up for junior partner. It was all good. After some chatting, he produced another newspaper. It seemed that Talbot McCoy was doing such a brilliant job of making the case that the people behind his client were the real wrongdoers, both in court and in the public eye. The partner looked troubled. This young man, he pointed at Talbot's picture, may wish to tone things down just a bit. He's defending his client, yes, and that's as it should be. He might wish to restrict his activity to the courtroom, however. The people he's calling out are not to be trifled with, and there's only so much of this sort of thing they'll put up with. Sometimes it's better just to go ahead and lose the case. We all know he's going to anyway. What do you mean? Look, Livingston. We all know the defendant is guilty as sin. He probably was last time, too, but there was enough sloppy police work we were able to get him acquitted. That's not the case this time, probably because the people he was working for did most of the cops' work for them. His only hope is to find someone guiltier than he is and focus attention on them. These people don't like being focused on, and when things happen that they don't like, they aren't very civilized. This young McCoy will tone it down, if he knows what's good for him. All right, I admit it. I was jealous. I had gotten some great publicity out of the schoolteacher case, and had gotten it by beating Talbot. For once in my life, I was ahead of him. Now he was going to fight the mob, or the drug cartels, or whoever it was our partner was hinting at, to get off, not a pillar of society, but a mobster. He was going to one-up me, and I was jealous. I never for a moment dreamed that anything really bad would happen to him. Barely a week later, our whole firm was abuzz. An attorney had been attacked and beaten within an inch of his life, carried to the steps of the courthouse and left there for dead. Obviously, the beating was related to a case and meant to send a message. I wondered who the attorney might be. No, that could be the case.my friendly partner stopped in with his newspaper. He looked subdued this morning, but not so subdued he forgot to ogle me. Discreetly, of course, but it was plain he approved of what he saw. I knew this young man should have just taken his losses, he said, pointing to the story about the beating. His client will be convicted in spite of his efforts, and it may be quite a while before he can practice law again. Talbot. It was a strangled whisper, dragged from me as my heart sank to my toes. Yes, Talbot McCoy, that's who it was. Hard luck on him, of course, but really, I'm sorry, sir, I have to go. I was out of my chair in an instant, and on the way to the door. I was halfway down the hall before I realized I didn't know where I was going. I didn't even have my purse. I dashed back into my office, where the partner was just heaving himself out of my guest chair. I snatched his newspaper, scanned the article for the name of the hospital, and handed it back to him. I snatched up my purse. Thanks, I said, smiling brightly at him so he would think I still had some manners, and dashed off again. Why was I doing this? I had no idea. It was pure instinct, just like everything else I'd done with Talbot as long as I'd known him, and made just as little sense. Did I still hate him? Of course I did. What would I do when I got there? What would I say? I had no more idea than a rabbit. I only knew I had to get there. Now.my emotions were in such turmoil I knew I'd never figure anything out, so I just concentrated on getting to the hospital and getting to wherever Talbot was. My headlong rush came to a screeching halt at the hospital's information desk. Mr. McCoy was in surgery, he would then go to the ICU, and would not be able to have visitors until at least the next afternoon. Now what? I didn't know what else to do, so I drove back to work. Fortunately, I had court appearances that afternoon, so I could put off dealing with my emotions. I worked late, forcing myself to think of other things, but I had to go home eventually. What the hell was I thinking? I hated Talbot McCoy. I'd hated him from the first day we met. I fully expected to go on hating him until one or the other of us died. Till death do us part. As it were. So, did I want to gloat over him? No, I wasn't that kind of person, even with him. Why did I want to see him, then, and so urgently? I heard myself saying to him, from long ago. We don't reason where we feel, we just feel. I shrugged my shoulders and went to bed. The next afternoon's hearing dragged on and on, with little nitpicky objections clogging up the works. I was only assisting, but it was one of the partner's cases, so I had to pay attention, but oh my, was it hard. The second the judge's gavel came down, I was out of there like a shot. So was the judge,
It was after 4 o'clock and he was more than ready for the adult beverage waiting for him in his chambers. This time, I got a room number and a pleasant smile from the information desk. He must not be dying then, I thought to myself. On my way to his room, I tried to think of what I would say. It was hopeless. I decided to do what I usually do, and just wing it. I was a lawyer, after all. I found his room, walked in the door, and halted as if I'd walked into a wall. It wasn't Talbot's poor mangled face, piteous as that was. It was the blonde sitting in the chair by the bed, holding his hand and leaning over him. She turned to face me. They both looked at me. I've never had a particularly high opinion of blondes. They so often turn out to be bimbos. Of course, I'm nice to them because I'm nice to everyone. This was no bimbo. Slim and elegant, with a classically beautiful face, she would be tall when she stood up, maybe even taller than I was. She was dressed plainly, but you could tell she was all woman under there. The blue eyes were intelligent. Genius that I am, it occurred to me that someone should say something. "Hi," I stammered. Silence descended again. I could see Talbot trying to make his mouth work in order to speak. "Monica Livingston," he croaked out. At least, that's what he was trying to say, being his usual gallant self. Hearing that once vibrant masculine voice reduced to such a pitiful whimper would have made a stone weep. Monica stood, smiled at him, proprietorially, and turned to me with her hand extended. "I'm Monica, Talbot and I have been seeing each other for a while." We shook hands. "You're Livingston? What a great name! I've heard so much about you from Talbot." She had? Then why was she still smiling? She pulled up a chair for me from the other side of the room, and we sat and talked. Talbot's condition was still guarded, she said, but the medical staff was more hopeful than they had been yesterday. Still, no one was talking about when he might be released. I watched Talbot as I listened. His eyes were on Monica almost the entire time. She looked at me as she talked, but every now and then, she would meet Talbot's eyes and smile that secret smile that lovers know. I didn't stay long. I couldn't. I took Talbot's hand, the hand that had so savagely beaten the asshole who attacked me, all those years ago, now so terribly weak, and told him goodbye and good luck. I told Monica I was glad to meet her, even though I had no idea whether or not I really was, and I fled into the hallway. Tears stung my eyes. I had to stop and wipe them to see where I was going, and cursed as I did so. What the hell was wrong with me? I hated Talbot McCoy. Here I was, stumbling down a hospital hallway, blubbering like a baby. I had to pull myself together. I noticed an open door ahead. It read "Chapel" on the square sign on the door. I peeked in, and luckily, it was empty. I closed the door behind me and sank down on a pew in the cool darkness. I looked up at the statue of Jesus and breathed a quick prayer, both for Talbot and myself. For some reason, I felt better. I leaned back in the pew and closed my eyes. What was wrong with me? I examined my emotions and they were rolling like a troubled sea under purple clouds. Suddenly the clouds parted and a blinding ray of light shone through, illuminating my soul. I didn't hate Talbot McCoy. I was in love with him. I had been in love with him since the first day of art class our junior year of high school. My own insecurities had blinded me. I knew Mom and Dad loved me, but I had never really understood why my birth parents hadn't. I had always felt that there must be something in me, some flaw, some hidden defect, that had made my birth mother so disgusted with me that she gave me up. All that hurt had drawn me up inside a hard shell that had allowed only Mom and Dad inside. I was afraid to let anyone close enough to see the real me. I knew they would see what my birth parents had seen, that I was deeply flawed and they would be disgusted with me. The insight staggered me to my core. Illusions I had sheltered myself with for years were sloughing off like dead skin, peeling after a sunburn. Yes, black people do sunburn. I was raw and hurting inside, the fresh skin sensitive to the wind of truth blowing over me. I sobbed. I was in love with Talbot McCoy. He was upstairs in a hospital room fighting for his life and there was a beautiful, sensitive, caring woman sitting beside him, obviously in love with him. She was healthy and whole, and he had looked at her with love in his eyes. I felt as if I were suffocating. I was in love with Talbot McCoy. I had been trying with all my might for 12 years to push him away so he wouldn't see that terrified little 3-year-old girl, walking reluctantly into that room at the orphanage to meet the man and woman who would become her parents, knowing that as soon as they saw her, they would realize that she was broken and unworthy of their love. And my heart broke for that little girl, and Livingston Brooks, the rising star of Goldblum. Perry and Tate, the valedictorian of her class, the confident courtroom shark, was that little girl and she was lost. I needed my mother. I found a restroom, washed my face and put on my sunglasses. I drove my car straight to my parents' house and when I went in, there was my little mother, just getting a chocolate pie out of the refrigerator. She took one look at me and I thought she was going to break her pie dish getting it set down on the counter. She rushed to take me in her arms and I sobbed out the anguish of my heart. All I was able to get out for some time is, "I love him, Mom, I love him." She just held me and whispered her words of love in my ear. "I know, baby, I've always known. I hope someday you'd figure it out too. It's okay, baby." "No, you don't understand," I sobbed. "He's met someone. She's beautiful and kind and smart, and I hate her." "No, you don't hate her, Livingston. You aren't able to hate anyone. I know you. You're as hard as nails on the outside, and I understand why. Inside, you're gooey and sweet and soft. Dad and I are the only ones that get to see that, but you can let Talbot in, baby. He'd never hurt you." "I know," I sobbed. "I've fucked everything up, Mom. I killed his love for me by being a bitch to him. What am I going to do?" She clucked at my language, but she knew. Win him back, she said. He's loved you for years. That didn't go away. The spark is still there. Fan it and make it come to life.
How?
I wondered. I don't know how to make someone love me. I've never tried. I have no clue about love. Just be yourself, she said. Do what you do, Livingston. Everyone who knows you loves you. She fed me pie and we snuggled until Dad came home. I was so ashamed of myself I couldn't look at him. God, what a bitch I'd been for all these years. He knew right away that something was wrong and the whole story came tumbling out. He was dumbfounded. He sat there with his mouth open like a man until Mom prodded him. Thomas Brooks, close your mouth and say something. Livingston is dying over here and all you can do is gape at her like a fool. He sprang to his feet, pulled me up and crushed me. I had no idea, Liv. I thought you hated Talbot.
So did I.
My voice was breaking again. I was not going to cry again. I was wrong and now he's in the hospital and I don't know how to get him to love me again.
In the hospital?
They were both shocked. I explained what had happened and I saw the wheels start turning in Mom's head. Livingston, have you done any pro bono work lately? She asked.
No, why?
I wondered. You're going to your boss tomorrow and telling him you want to be assigned to this case. She said. You're going to do some pro bono work so the firm looks good. You're going to work with Talbot and you're going to get his client acquitted. That will put the two of you together, and then you just wait and see what happens. You can't treat him as if he has leprosy anymore, though. I want him to see my sweet little angel. Do you understand, Livingston?
Well, yes, I said.
The problem is I don't really want the guy acquitted. He's a scumbag. Half the people you represent are scumbags, Dad said. Do you believe that scumbags have the right to be represented by counsel at a fair trial?
Well, yes, I said.
He's human. He has rights.
See to it that he gets them, he said.
Now, take us down to the hospital so we can see Talbot. We're going to stop on the way and you're going to get him some nice flowers. That's exactly what we did. My friend at the information desk informed us politely, but firmly, that visiting hours would be over in 5 minutes, so we might as well wait until tomorrow. That wasn't happening. I already knew Talbot's room number. So while Dad engaged the desk in conversation, Mom and I headed purposefully for the elevator. When the doors opened, Dad gave the desk his patented mail.
Oh, well, what can you do?
Shrugged and ran after us. All three of us were shocked at Talbot's condition, including me, and I'd seen it already. Whoever had done this to him clearly didn't care whether he survived or not. Mom and I just sort of gaped at him. Dad, bless his heart, sat down next to Talbot and started a one-sided conversation about pretty much anything except law, hospitals, and people getting beaten up. I was trying to figure out how in the world I managed not to admit I loved this man, and what I was going to do about it, when through the fog of my thoughts I heard Dad say, Livingston brought you something. I put the flowers on his bedside table while I tried to think of something to say. Did Talbot's eyes mist up, or was that my imagination? Maybe it was the pain he must be in. Come on, Livingston Brooks, you hotshot lawyer, say something.
Talbot, I'm taking your case.
His eyes widened, and I could see him trying to shake his head.
No.
Danger. He finally managed to croak out. I took his poor weak hand in both of mine.
I know, Talbot.
Of course, you know this proves you were right all along. Bandini is guilty as sin, we all know that, but it's the people who hired him who need to be put away. I intend to make that happen, and you know I can do it. He tried to smile. His mouth didn't cooperate, but I saw it in his eyes.
Fence.
He croaked.
Fence?
I was puzzled for a moment.
Oh, you mean defense.
I always do defense.
You're right, I'll probably hate myself for the rest of my life for being on the wrong side of the courtroom. But if it means nailing the bastards who did this, it's worth it.
I spoke with all the conviction in my heart. I hated them far worse than I'd ever hated anyone, including Talbot. His eyes looked a warning at me.
Einar,
he said again.
I know, Talbot. It will be dangerous, and I know you can't rescue me this time. I'll be careful. Some people at my firm have connections, and I'll be safe.
Obihiach Ivy, he said.
Nobody touches Livy.
I interpreted.
Talbot.
There was steel in my voice. Love him or hate him, I was not Livy. I could swear his eyes were twinkling just like they used to. Whatever those bastards had done to his body, he was still Talbot, through and through.
Yelloward,
he croaked. I heard my mom give an unladylike giggle slash snort behind me just before I figured it out.
Three syllables too hard.
I laughed. I couldn't help myself.
All right, I'll give you a pass this time. But my name is Livingston, and don't you forget it.
I smiled as I said it, so it wouldn't sting.
Sure thing, Liv.
Dad piped up behind me. I turned to glare at him, only to see him and Mom smiling at me with their arms around each other, and all their love for me in their eyes. I mean, talk about unfair, but what was I going to do? I just smiled back at them. Talbot was obviously getting tired, so we got ready to leave. I told him I'd visit often and keep him posted on the case. Dad told him he was betting on him. It would have sounded hokey coming from anyone else, but it seemed to encourage Talbot. We said goodbye. The moment we were out of sight of Talbot's room, Dad turned toward the nearest wall, leaned against it with his head on his arm, and sobbed. Great, silent, heartbroken sobs like I never could have imagined. He'd been a rock when we were with Talbot, now we could see how he really felt. Mom hugged him from one side and I hugged him from the other while his body shook with his sobs. We could hear hospital people going by us in the hallway. I guess they were used to this sort of thing. Dad quieted, then straightened up. He looked a thanks at both of us, then led the way to the elevators with a steady stride and a grim face. We drove home in silence. It had been a long day. When we got into the house, my parents looked at me, then they put me in between them and squeezed me, just like they did when I was that scared little girl. I'm half a foot taller than Mom is now, so you might think it would feel different. It didn't, not one little bit. Never gonna let you go, girl. Dad rumbled at me. Nope, never gonna happen, said Mom. Just as always, when we broke apart, we had tears in our eyes and big grins on our faces. Livingston, you're going to nail those sons of bitches, Dad said, with that voice and look that makes you sure you can do anything, the same one he gave Talbot. He really was a damn fine coach. Liv, you'll get him back, Mom told me. How do you know? I asked. Because he wants you to. She just stood there with that, Mama knows, look on her face, and I couldn't help believing her. Have I mentioned how amazingly awesome my parents are, and how much I love them? It wasn't until I was home, getting ready for bed, that I realized that was the first time I'd ever heard Dad curse that I thought a lot about how I was going to wangle a temporary assignment to the public defender's office. I knew Mr. Tate, the managing partner, slightly. He was pretty sensitive about the firm's reputation. We weren't exactly known for sticking up for the little guy, so I figured I could sell him on some high-profile pro bono work. It all went perfectly until he asked why I wanted to go to the public defender's office. I want to take the Bandini case. What? I stuck my chin out and repeated. I want the Bandini case, and I think I can win it. Livingston, you know good and well he's guilty. The only way you'll get him off is by nailing the people behind him. After what happened to poor McCoy, we all know who they are. Yes, sir. Are you under some sort of mistaken impression that they'll take it easy on you because you're a woman? Hell, Livingston, they'll just, you know. He couldn't bring himself to say it. Rape me first, then beat me? They'll have to catch me first, and I don't intend to be caught. Neither did McCoy. He sighed and looked at me sadly. Look, Livingston, I know how you feel. We all feel that way. We talk a lot about how hard we fight in court, and our take-no-prisoners attitude, but that's all figurative. What happened to McCoy was real. We never dreamed something like this would happen to one of us, an attorney, over a case. You haven't been here very long, but everyone here, from me down to the janitor, likes you and respects you. We're proud of you, and you have a great future here. We don't want to see that future put in jeopardy over a scumbag like Bandini. More important, Livingston, we don't want to see you hurt, or even killed. That's a real possibility, you know. He paused. I could tell he was truly concerned about me, and I was touched, but I knew what I had to do. Do you still want to do this? Yes, sir. All right, then, I'll make the arrangements. He coughed into his sleeve. There's one more thing, Livingston. You're going to need help. I bristled at him, but he snapped at me before I could get a word out. There's a one-word description for the Lone Rangers who go after people like this by themselves. That word is dead. Now shut up and listen. It was an order. I listened. His face was sad again. There's a man I know. We were best friends long ago, way back when we both had ideals. He's a cop. Nobody in this town knows more than he does about the mob. Treat him right, and he'll help you. At least, he'll get protection for you, and you'll need it. He took a blank card and wrote a name and phone number on it from memory. That's his private phone. Mention my name before he hangs up on you. I took the card and tried to pronounce Joseph Pshibilovich. I failed miserably. He stood and offered me his hand. Good luck, Livingston. Let us know if there's anything we can do for you. Thank you, sir. I'll make you proud. I almost felt like I was saying it to my dad. Yeah, just don't make me have to say it at your funeral. I started to smile, then I realized he wasn't kidding. There's one thing that's always safe to say to a senior partner. Yes, sir. We shook hands and I left his office. I'd never thought of Mr. Tate as someone who cared much about the people at the firm. Cared about them as people, I mean. This was the first time I'd had more than two sentences with him, and I was surprised how much he seemed to care about me. Maybe my hard shell had deprived me of more than Talbot? Oh, well, I would think about that later. I had work to do. I didn't bother to wait for the paperwork. I went straight to the head public defender's office, told her who I was, what I was doing there, and that I wanted the Bandini case. She looked at me funny. Why that one? I have my reasons. Any reason I shouldn't have it? None at all. No one else around here will touch it with a 10-foot pole, so if you want it, it's yours. Bring me the paperwork when you have it, and I'll release the files to you. Check that one off the list. I was on a roll, so I headed to the district attorney's office for a conference with my opposite number. I could have done this by phone, of course, but I thought the personal touch might be more effective. Especially since I'd dressed for a senior partner. I saw a couple of male heads pop up over the cubicle walls when I said Bandini, so very clearly. Sure enough, I didn't even have to wait half an hour before one of them came round and introduced himself as Devin Williams, ADA on the Bandini case. It's usual to let the prosecutor lead off at these meetings, and he gave me the usual stuff about how bulletproof his case was, and how I might as well plead my client guilty and save the taxpayers money. I asked what I would get in return, and we danced around that for a while. I hadn't been practicing long, but I could already do this part in my sleep. I spent the time polishing what I would say about the real business of the meeting. I wanted to postpone Bandini's trial while we went after his bosses.
I built a case including the attack on Talbot, which any attorney should hate regardless of which side they were on. I said all we had to do was get something on one of Bandini's bosses, and then Bandini would testify himself. Once the bosses were settled, we could let the small fry go free. I was going pretty well when he interrupted me.
No.
What?
No.
McCoy put the same thing to me, and it's no deal.
Why?
Nailing a big boss like that would make your career. Heck, I'd even help you do it, and I'm a defense attorney.
What's the problem?
You aren't afraid, are you?
No, Ms. Brooks, that's not it. Although it would make sense if I were afraid. I don't know where McCoy, and now you, get off thinking you're a match for these people.
You're not. There are two reasons my answer is no. First, this case will make my career as it is, and it's a slam dunk. You either plead him guilty to all the charges, or you get trounced in court. This is the surest thing I'll ever have. I'm not giving it up. Second, my boss told me not to.
What?
But why? I thought he was trying to make a reputation as a big mob fighter so he could run for Congress. Devin looked thoughtful for a moment. McCoy asked me the same thing, and I'm still not sure why. And yes, I do know Bandini's bosses are throwing him under the bus for some reason. But,
he became brisk again.
That isn't important. What matters is he gave me my orders, and told me it's as much as my job is worth to disobey them. So I said yes, sir, and one mobster conviction coming right up, sir. There didn't seem to be much to say after that. There wasn't anything more I could do without the paperwork, so I went back to my office and gave thanks for a door I could close. I hate cubicles. The interview with my client went even worse than the meeting with Devin. He knew he'd been set up, he'd been paid to do what he did. But he wouldn't say anything else. I threatened, I cajoled, I told him nailing his bosses was the only hope we had of getting him off, and all he did was ask me how long his sentence was going to be. It was the most frustrating experience of my life. Even Talbot at his worst hadn't been this bad. Or maybe he had, but I didn't look at it the same way anymore. I was running out of options. It finally occurred to me to find out who had been investigating Talbot's beating, and see if they'd come up with anything. I did, and it was the guy whose name Mr. Tate had given me. At least I thought it was. The first name was Joe, and the last name was long and sounded like a Polish sneeze. That was close enough for me. Reluctantly, I decided to call him. I've never liked cops. It's not a race thing. I don't like black cops either. People who go out and get a job where they tell other people what to do just rub me the wrong way. I haven't had any terrible experiences with cops, like some people I know. In the experience I've had, they either do the wrong thing, or try to do the right thing and screw it up, or show up too late to do anything at all. I don't like cops. I knew what this Polish Joe character looked like before I even dialed the phone. Balding, short, fat, out of shape, double-chinned, disgusting man-boobs making dents in his too-tight shirt, and narrow squinty little eyes focused on my tits. I shuddered as I dialed the phone.
Yeah?
The voice's owner clearly wished I would go away.
Mr.
Prizeblow Dash,
yeah, who's Callan?
I introduced myself, told him Mr. Tate had referred me, and that I had taken on the Bandini case. The only response was low, heavy, slightly asthmatic breathing. Oh, crap, a perv on top of it all, I shuddered. I was trying to decide whether to repeat myself, ask if he was okay, or just hang up.
Why?
It felt like the query was shot from a gun.
What?
I reacted.
Why?
Why would you take that case? He acted as if he was talking to an infant with water on the brain. I began to explain about the firm wanting to polish its image, my wanting to do some pro bono work.
Bullcrap.
You get one more chance cause you're a babe.
Why?
The statement snapped like a whip. With a passing thought that this guy would be murder in an interrogation room, I decided to tell him the truth, or most of it. You know Talbot McCoy, the PD who was on the case? He and I went to school together, and my dad was his football coach, so we've known each other forever. Well, for a long time, anyway. It just seemed like I should do it. More silence. I hated myself for feeling, and sounding, so insecure.
All right, fair enough.
We'll talk. He gave me a time the next day, and complicated directions to a secluded place in a public park.
Got that?
He hung up before I could answer. I was proud of myself for arriving exactly on time, and for dressing down. My professional clothes would be out of place here. He arrived at exactly the same time from another direction. He looked exactly as I imagined, except his eyes were constantly in motion and hardly ever on me.
We have 5 minutes.
I talk, you listen. If Bandini is anywhere but jail now and for the next few years, he's a dead man. That's why he won't squeal or cooperate with you. He wants to be convicted. Your only hope of getting to the guys behind him is through the attack on McCoy. I'm working on that, but it's slow going. Witnesses to this kind of thing have a habit of turning up dead. I'm going to arrange protection for you. You'll give me your address and a phone where I can reach you. I'll handle it from there. Don't get that high and mighty look with me, or I turn around and walk away and you take your chances. You've been visiting McCoy at the same time every day. Stop doing that. Change it up. Don't be predictable. If I get something, I'll call you on the phone you used last night. If you get something, call me on the number Tate gave you. Only use the phone to set something up, not for other stuff. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Prizeblow Dash. You'll never get it right, you ain't Polish. Just call me Jopie.
Wait, what?
He sighed.
Jopie.
You know Joe P, got it? I got it. I gave him the address of my apartment. I tried to thank him, but realized I was talking to his back and gave up. I slumped down on a bench to think for a while.
I never thought I would meet a competent cop. Now I had. If this Jopie didn't know what he was doing, I was a blonde. I was aware that I was entering another world. Jopie's and Bandini's world. The partners at my law firm, Devin Williams, and even Talbot didn't know it existed, not really. The shadow world thing was supposed to make me afraid. Well, good luck with that, I thought. I squared my shoulders and went to see Talbot. I thought Talbot's color looked better today. Maybe that was just wishful thinking. He was still almost completely covered with wraps, casts, bandages and so on. He did look like he was glad to see me. Monica was there, so I couldn't get too personal. I just filled him in on the news. I told him that I'd struck out with the DA on the Bandini case, just as he had. I thought Monica gave me a funny look when I said that, but I could have been imagining that, too. I couldn't stay long. Seeing him helpless and hurting like that, and seeing him look lovingly at another woman was tearing my heart out. I couldn't let him see that, of course, so I just smiled at him as hard as I could, told him to get better and left. I paused at the end of the hallway to collect myself. I'm not a crier. When I get hurt, I don't weep. I get even, and more if I can, and I was fighting mad. Whoever did that to Talbot, no, whoever ordered that to be done to Talbot, was going to wish they hadn't, if it was the last thing I did. Before I could turn and stride away, there were quick footsteps behind me and a light hand on my shoulder. I spun on my heel to see Monica. She handed me a card. Don't read it here, she whispered. She turned and was gone. At home that evening, I pulled out the card Monica had given me. Monica Bennett, CPA, Audit Division, Latham & Revere, Investment Bankers. There was a downtown address and a phone number. On the back was written, please call, and a different phone number. It must have been her personal cell. The area code was out of state. I was pretty sure she wanted to talk about Talbot. That was the last thing I wanted, but the please was underlined twice, so I shrugged and dialed the number. Monica wasted no time on pleasantries. We needed to talk. It couldn't be at her place or mine, or at either of our offices. She proposed a conference room at the public library, the next afternoon. I agreed, and she hung up. That was odd, I thought. What could she say about Talbot that had to be so hush-hush? I was punctual to the minute. Monica ushered me into the room, dimmed the lights, and started a movie playing on the computer. Finally, we shook hands and she thanked me for coming. She talked so low I could barely hear her over the movie. She had been hired almost straight out of business school into the audit division of Latham & Revere, which she described as the biggest investment bank that no one had ever heard of. A few months ago, she had run across some well-hidden transactions that looked suspiciously like money laundering. She traced them, and after a lot of winding and doubling back, one of those transactions ended in a payment to Goldblum, Perry, and Tate for legal fees relating to one Sam Bandini. There were rumors at our place about that too. Why didn't you tell Talbot? I was going to, she answered. But that was the night he was attacked. Do you think there's a connection? Hell, I don't know. I knew someone who would, though. There's a guy who's helping me with the case. Let me put it to him and see what he says. Thank you, Livingston. She paused and blushed a little. I knew what was coming next, or thought I did. You love him, don't you? No, that's not what I expected. While I goggled at her and spluttered, she smiled this serene smile at me. It's okay. He talked about you a lot, you know. He always said you loved him, and you'd figure it out someday. I guess now you have. She looked away from me and collected herself. When she turned back toward me, she was friendly, but all business. I'm so glad to have met you, Livingston. I'm glad to think we'll be working together on this, and Talbot will be pleased, too. I'll pass along your information and tell you what my contact says. I'm sure he'll be interested. I'll be in touch, I said. Thanks again, Livingston. I'll look forward to hearing from you. It was a standard professional sentence, but I could see that she really meant it, and not just for the case. Damn it, why do the people I try to hate always like me? We stood, shook hands. No, Talbot's girlfriend was not going to get a hug from me, no matter how smart and beautiful and kind she was, and parted. Shake hands, come out fighting, and may the best girl win, I thought. As long as it's me, I was pretty sure Jopie would be interested in Monica's news, but he called me before I had a chance to call him. We met in a squalid little interrogation room at the jail where Bandini was being held. Why here? Don't you guys record every conversation that goes on in here, whether you tell the sucker or not? Yeah. That's how I can make sure this one isn't recorded. Well, I guess that made sense. Jopie had found a witness who saw the car from which Talbot had been dumped on the courthouse steps. He traced the car back to a guy named Silvio, who was some kind of boss in the same outfit as Bandini. Jopie had one of his guys take what he called an unobtrusive little look at the inside of the car. It had been cleaned recently, but they had missed a spot. A blood spot that matched Talbot's. I was ecstatic. We were finally getting somewhere. Jopie set me straight. For a hotshot lawyer, you're pretty dumb. If Silvio were your client, you'd tear that to rags, wouldn't you? I had to admit he was right. Listen to me. This ain't some football game where you cheer for every first down. Every time you think you're getting somewhere, you stop and look around, cause all you've done is increase the odds they're gonna do something nasty to you. Believe me, I know. He looked away to hide the sudden pain in his eyes, and then glared at me. The only time you get to cheer is when they're dead. And even then, you better be looking out for their replacement, cause they're sure as hell looking out for you. I felt like a scolded kindergartner, but I knew he was right. Then I remembered Monica's message. You remember my firm defended Bandini last time, and some people thought there was some funny business about how we were paid. This accountant, Monica Bennett, traced the payments. She thinks they were laundered.
Monica Bennett? Who's she? How'd she meet you?
She's an accountant at this investment bank.
I met her. Well, I met her in Talbot's room.
She his girlfriend? I couldn't bring myself to say it. I just nodded. For a moment, I thought I saw a flash of pity in Jopie's eyes. I must have imagined it.
What firm?
Latham and Revere.
Oh, shit.
What? Shut up, I'm thinking. Which he did for a few long minutes. How long has she been there?
I don't know, about a year, maybe.
She blonde?
Yes, how did you, shut up.
I did. All right, what neither of you know is that Latham and Revere, he pronounced the name with undisguised bitterness, is a wholly owned subsidiary of our buddy Silvio's crew. They thought they were hiring a dumb blonde who would say the right things to the feds and not ask questions. She's on their radar twice, at LNR and for being McCoy's girlfriend. You tell her, no, wait, when she calls you, tell her to keep her head way down. I'll try to arrange some protection for her, but I can't do anything inside LNR. He thought another minute. What do you think of her, Brooks? He saw the look on my face.
No, not that. Has she got brains?
Courage?
Brains, definitely.
Courage?
Don't know yet.
Fair enough. Stay in touch with her if you can do it quietly. Don't talk with her about anything in McCoy's hospital room. Act like normal women.
Hell, I don't know.
Just remember his room, and probably his entire floor, are monitored.
Okay?
I told him how we'd met at the library. He approved. I felt an irrational glow at having done something that pleased him. Monica called me 2 days later. We met at the student union at the local college. She was good. You'd have thought we were a young prof and an underclassman discussing research. I passed along Jopie's concern.
I'd been wondering about that.
She nodded. It fits with what I've found so far. I haven't traced any payments all the way back. I don't think I can do that without asking questions. I've seen enough to know it's definitely money laundering, and I have 6 names of people I know are in the chain. She handed me a piece of paper. I read it, or tried to read it.
What is this, some kind of code?
She smiled.
Sort of.
I wanted to make it a little harder for them to figure out what I'm up to, so all my notes are in Old Church Slavonic. My great-grandfather was an Orthodox monk, if you must know. Here, I'll transliterate them for you. She quickly wrote the 6 names in good old ordinary American. I had to admit, that was smart. There's one more thing. 2 of the payments I've traced ended up in politics. Our crime-fighting DA is running his campaign with money funneled through LNR. I told Jopie about it the next day. His reaction surprised me.
Well, that's that, he said philosophically.
What? I seemed to say that a lot around him. The attack on McCoy will never be prosecuted now, he explained. I'll never go for the small fry, unless I can make them sing, and the DA won't touch Silvio.
What do we do now?
Jopie thought for a moment. How are you with RICO? RICO is the Federal Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a sort of hate crimes act against mobsters. I told him I hadn't studied it in a few years, but it wouldn't take me long to get it back under my fingers.
Here's what we do. You and Bennett are going to build the money laundering case. You know the law. You tell her what financial stuff you need. She gets it for you, and you pass it to me. I'll take care of chain of custody and all that.
Why can't she meet directly with you? We want her to survive. He paused and let me think about it. Strike 1, they're keeping their eye on everyone in internal audit who they think might be honest. Strike 2, she's McCoy's girlfriend. Meeting me would be strike 3, and she's out.
Understood?
I nodded. Anything you need that isn't about the money, contact me. When we've got enough, we'll wrap it all up in a nice neat package and put a pretty little bow on it, and drop it on the federal prosecutor's doorstep in the middle of the night, and walk away.
Why do we walk away?
We get off their radar, or rather you and Bennett do, and we all live longer.
Especially her.
He thought a moment. One more thing. Tomorrow, you go talk to the ADA, and you open a nice long complicated negotiation about how you're going to plead Bandini.
What?
Why would I do that? Brooks, please try to get this. You're on these people's radar now, just like I am, just like Bennett is. This is not a good thing. You can't get off it as long as you're on the Bandini case. So you try to act like you're not going to cause them any trouble, and you hope they believe it and ignore you. He stood up.
Follow me, there's some stuff you'll want in my desk.
I followed him to a dark corner of the squad room. It made Talbot's cubicle in the PD's office look like a partner's office by comparison.
Hey, don't turn up your dainty little nose.
I worked 15 years to get this corner office. Well, he was right, it was in a corner. That's about all that could be said for it. I looked around while he pulled files out of a drawer. There was one picture on his desk, of a younger Jopie with a stunning dark-haired woman, slightly taller than he was.
Who's that?
I asked, when he had finished pulling files.
My ex.
He spoke bitterly. If he was still that upset at her, why was her picture on his desk?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. He turned from me and busied himself with the files. Realizing he'd been rude, he pointed me to a chair and sat down. He didn't look at me. He told his story without emotion, staring off into the distance like a middle schooler reciting in class.
Silvio came to my house one afternoon. He knew I wouldn't be there. He just knocked on the door.
She opened it a little, he forced his way in. He brought 3 guys. 2 to hold her, 1 to run the video camera. She was terrified, begging and pleading with him not to hurt her. No, I won't hurt you this time, he said with a smarmy grin. This ain't about you. It's about your husband. I have a message for him. He pulled out a knife. Silvio loves knives. Slowly, deliberately, he proceeded to cut every stitch of clothing off her body. One button at a time. He never touched her, and didn't touch her clothes except with the knife. It took more than 10 minutes. When he finished, she was just standing there quivering while the two goons held her up. He took his knife, put it between her breasts. The point just touching the skin. Message time, he says. He cut the letter S right into the skin between her breasts. Not deep, barely enough to draw blood, and leave a scar. I shuddered. Jesus, Jopie, I'm so sorry. He shrugged. He examined his handiwork and put his knife away. She was about to faint. Don't forget to give hubby my message, he said. She did faint then. The goons laid her down on the floor. On second thought, he said, turning to the camera, I'll deliver it myself. The recording was delivered to me right here, in the squad room. Of course, I went straight home, and took her to the ER. 2 weeks later, I came home to a note. She had left. She couldn't handle the danger. She loved me and respected me and wished me well, but she couldn't handle, and I couldn't protect her. He stopped. I saw his shoulders shaking. I couldn't help it. I put my arms around him and pulled him into me, and he cried into my shoulder. I meant to kiss the top of his head. I swear that's all I meant, like my dad does to me. The next thing I knew, we were kissing. For real. Deep tongue, the whole works. He kissed my eyes, he kissed my chin, he nibbled on my lips, and he even kissed my nose. I was no less voracious than he was. My pulse raced, my breathing was shallow. I could feel my nipples erecting, trying to push their way toward him through the fabric of my bra. My hands were behind his head, running through what little hair he had, caressing him. I didn't remember telling them to do that. I could smell my arousal. His fingers were buried in my hair as his strong hands held me in place while he ravished my face. Time stopped. He pushed my face away from his, ever so gently. Thank you, was all he said. I couldn't speak. My legs had turned to jelly and my heart was still galloping madly. I had to use my hands on his desk to push myself up. I nodded at him, and set off on wobbly legs for the exit sign. I forgot about the files. It was one confused girl who came home to my apartment that night. The idea that I loved Talbot was taking some getting used to, but I was making progress. Then there was Monica. She loved Talbot, that was clear, and she was worthy of him, too. I was the competition she never wanted. Why did she like me, and why, as hard as I tried to hate her, couldn't I? I know Mom said I couldn't hate her, but she's Mom, she's supposed to say things like that. What if she was right, though? What became of the protective covering that the scared little girl who still sometimes lived in my skin so desperately needed? Just be yourself. Mom had said. How did I even do that? I got nowhere with that, so I found something else to think about. Something else. Was worse. I had kissed a cop. I mean, really kissed him. While I was in love with Talbot. I didn't even have the excuse that he was good-looking, or charming, or anything. How on earth had that happened? I didn't love Jopie. I wasn't sure I even liked him. In so many ways, he was the stereotypical cop I'd always hated. Something about him connected with me, though. It went deeper than his story, horrible as that was. I began to think he lived inside a hard shell just like I did, and my trivial question about a picture on his desk had gotten through his shell and revealed his profound loneliness. Whatever it was, I knew, and I knew he knew, he could have had a lot more from me than he took. I was ready to do something we'd both have regretted. He, this stereotypical Polish Joe of a cop, had the self-control to stop before it could happen. My brain ached. I'm not good at introspection, and I avoid it whenever I can, but the day's events seemed to leave me no choice. I was just thinking that I could do without any more days like this, when the doorbell rang. I was surprised to notice it was almost 10 p.m. I looked out the peephole to see a uniformed police officer holding up his ID. I opened the door, leaving the chain on. Ms. Livingston Brooks? The guy looked about 16. I found myself wondering if he'd started shaving yet. The ID was genuine, though, so I said, Yes? He handed me a small plain envelope with my name handwritten on it. Then he reached down and picked up a slender glass vase containing a single flower, the most beautiful white rose I'd ever seen. He handed it to me. You have been served. My jaw fell open. Mr. Junior Officer smiled and winked at me, then closed my door for me. I tore open the envelope. Livingston. I read. Thank you. You will never know how much I needed what you gave me. Be assured it will never be repeated, but will be treasured and gratefully remembered for the rest of my life. It was signed with his full name, Joseph Pshibilovich. My eyes began to sting with tears. That settled it. I needed my mother. I could tell she had been asleep, but she never said a word of reproach. She's like that. I told her everything, Talbot, Monica, Jopie, the whole mess. What do I do now? I wailed. You do exactly what we talked about. Be yourself. I thought about that for a moment. How? I heard Mom's familiar chuckle. You'll know. Don't overthink it, Livingston. You're an amazing, wonderful person. Your dad and I have known that since you were three, and that scared little girl bravely walked across that room into our arms. Now everyone who gets to know you falls in love with you. One of these days, you'll realize that. She had that Mama Knows tone in her voice. She always did know, too. Have I mentioned she's awesome? Mom, what does a single white rose mean? It means innocence, Livingston. I tried to think about that, but my brain had closed down for the time being, and we said goodnight. I decided to take my medicine first thing next morning. I went to the DA's office, requested a meeting with Mr. Devin Williams, and prepared to plead my client, but take my own sweet time doing it. I understood the objective, string them along, make them think I wasn't a threat, until we were ready to drop an anvil on their head, figuratively, of course. When I thought about what they'd done to Talbot and Jopie, though, I wouldn't have minded someone doing it literally. That didn't make the smug expression on Mr. Williams' face, or his remark about my coming to my senses, easier to take. I called Jopie and asked to see him, partly because I wanted some good news and hoped he had some, and partly to reconnect with him after the day before. I struck out on both counts. The hard shell was back in place. Yesterday might as well not have happened. He didn't have any good news, and he was sore about that, too. When our brief conference ended, I wasn't sure whether to cry or tell him off. Usually when we finished, he just turned his back and walked away. Today he looked at me a little funny, and held out his hand. Grumpily, I shook his hand, and then he stalked off. Something was in my hand, a single rose petal, slightly crumpled, but pure white. I understood. They finally began to peel off the bandages and whatnot from Talbot. His jaw was still wired, so it was still hard to understand him, but he had more stamina now, and better control over his lips and tongue. I visited him every day, being sure to vary my times as Jopie had told me. Sometimes, Mom or Dad, or both, came with me. We couldn't stay long, because he still tired easily. The doctors told us that his body needed all its energy to rebuild muscle and heal bones. They were very pleased that he was sleeping 16 to 20 hours a day. We didn't talk about the case. I didn't talk much about my discovery that I loved him, either. The doctors told us to avoid upsetting him, and besides, I had no idea how one did this sort of thing. I've hated you for 12 years, but I didn't really. I was only acting that way. I really love you. Not so much. I couldn't help giving him little affectionate touches from time to time, though, and even drugged up as he was, I knew he was starting to figure some things out. Mom and Dad were there with me when they removed the bandages from the top part of his head. You remember he'd had this mop of curly hair just like mine, only shorter? Not anymore. They'd shaved it all, and now he only had stubble. I cried inside. Talbot saw it and looked sad, so I went over and kissed the top of his head, and ran my hand over his stubble. He liked that, so I did it every time I said goodbye to him, except when Monica was there. Mom and Dad met Monica when she happened to come in while we were there. She was varying her visit times, too, after I passed along Jopie's message. They were both impressed with her. After we got home, I asked them what they thought of her. Dad didn't say anything, but I was pretty sure I knew what he thought anyway. Mom didn't disappoint me. She's a wonderful girl, Livingston. I'm so glad you have her for a friend. You've never really had a best friend, you know, and she's absolutely perfect for you. She paused, just to tease me, I think. She knew that's not what I wanted to know. Well, it was, but it wasn't, if you know what I mean. She loves Talbot, but she knows now that it's over, or almost over, between them. She knows long term that you're his girl. The wonderful thing is, she's happy for you. How can she do that? Why doesn't she hate me? Part of it is how much she likes you. Mostly, though, she loves him, so she wants what's best for him, and she knows that's you. Monica and I were meeting 3 or 4 times a week. Working with her was amazing. Rico is pretty complex, but I never had to explain anything to her more than once. She always brought me all the information I asked for, never said anything about it being hard or getting her in trouble, and had good ideas on her own. I never asked how she did it, and Jopie told me I didn't want to know anyway, but I could tell he was pleased with how things were going. The more we worked together, the better I liked her. She was straight as an arrow, and had no more back down in her than I did. She was nowhere close to as strong as I was, physically, and didn't get angry as easily, but I wouldn't have wanted to fight her over something she cared about. There wasn't a dishonest bone in her body. She couldn't even lie about what she and Talbot had gotten up to before the attack. I liked prodding her to talk about Talbot, and it was fun watching her blush. She got me back, though, by repeating things Talbot had told her about me. After one of our meetings, I was startled to realize that Monica was probably the best friend I'd ever had in my life. I hadn't had a close girlfriend growing up, and this brilliant, beautiful, kind and honest blonde girl had made it obvious she thought I hung the moon. She was well on her way to becoming the sister I'd never had. When this was over and we could relax, we were going to have some great times together. I had started to think of us as the Three Musketeers, battling evil in our somewhat unorthodox way. I was spending 10 to 12 hours a day putting together what we knew, figuring out what we needed next, and documenting everything for an airtight case against Silvio. Once a week, I turned myself into Silvio's defense attorney, and tried to find the holes in our case. My hatred for him hadn't abated a bit, but instead of a hot rage, I was coldly calculating, as Jopie taught me. Every now and then, I met with Devin Williams, just to keep him interested and show our foes I was playing nice. Jopie came through with physical evidence, cataloged everything, and documented the chain of custody. I had mostly stopped telling Monica specific things we needed. She knew the law now, and knew L and R's, we'd taken to calling them. Lousy and rotten. Between ourselves, finances like the back of her hand, so I trusted her to bring me what I needed. I was meeting with Jopie late one afternoon. The case was almost finished. I was going to meet with Monica that evening, and if she came through as usual, I thought we would have everything we needed. I would turn defense attorney one more time, then go through everything once more with Jopie. If everything passed, we would give the federal prosecutor the best Christmas present of his life. We were discussing how to package and deliver it, when my phone rang. It was Monica, canceling our meeting. I didn't think much about it, until I told Jopie and saw the look on his face.
Why?
The query snapped at me. She didn't say.
Why, do you think something's wrong?
Yeah, Brooks, I always think something's wrong. That's why I'm still alive. Has she canceled on you before?
She hadn't.
As I thought about it, I began to be nervous as well. I knew her well, now, and I knew she had courage. I knew she hated Silvio as much as Jopie and I did. She knew how close we were to the finish line, and she wouldn't cancel without a good reason. Jopie told me to go home, and he tried to find out what might be going on. I looked into his eyes. I saw the same worry and determination that I felt myself that I had just gotten home when Monica called again. She had been asked to stay after closing to meet with one of the partners, and something didn't seem right to her. She was about to say something else when she whispered,
"Someone's coming,"
and hung up. This was serious. Monica knew who we were up against, and didn't scare easily. I was out of my apartment, into my car, and on my way downtown in about 90 seconds. I drive a hybrid. Now you might not think I'd get there very quickly, driving a hybrid, but you'd be very wrong. When you graduate at the top of your class from a top 10 law school, firms are falling all over themselves to recruit you. I got a huge bonus when I joined the firm. You probably wouldn't believe how huge if I told you. Well, it's none of your business. Anyway, I wanted to own a Porsche since I was old enough to know what a car was. I was one of the 297 lucky people in the US to get a 918 Spider. It's powered by a 4.6-liter V8 that makes 608 horsepower. The hybrid part is two electric motors that give it an additional 279 horsepower. I can go from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds and I didn't stop at 60. I called Jopie as I drove.
"Trouble, LNR,"
was all I said. He was even briefer.
"Yup."
I didn't get pulled over as I pulled every stop out, flying around corners and throwing myself into every turn. I parked in the block behind the main entrance of Latham and Revere and jumped out of my car. I saw no one as I made my way around to the front of the building. They weren't being subtle. Four, no, five men in almost identical suits emerged from the front door, surrounding Monica. She was limping on one of her high heels. She didn't see me. Accidentally or on purpose, the other shoe buckled under her and was left on the ground. There was a break in the circle of thugs as they reacted.
"Run, Monica!"
Our eyes met as she dashed toward me through the small break. She was about 20 yards from me when she stumbled slightly in her bare feet on the sidewalk. She didn't fall, but it slowed her enough for a couple of the goons to catch up to her. She screamed as they swept her legs out from under her and swung her up into the air. As they carried her away from me, the other three caught up. My part was obvious. Create enough havoc that they couldn't get away with Monica before Jopie and the cavalry showed up. My pleasure, thought I. I picked the goon on the end who was fumbling for some kind of weapon, led with my shoulder, hit him going full speed, and drove him into the ground. It was a textbook tackle, just like Dad taught me. His head made a sort of crunchy squishy sound as it hit the pavement. I didn't think I'd have to worry about him anymore. I popped up, ready for more mayhem. Goon number two was turning around to face me. I remembered watching a football game on television with Dad, and seeing him cringe when it looked like one player intentionally took out another player's knee. He called the guy the dirtiest player in football. I practiced that move a few times. It's called a leg whip. I went down on my butt, got one leg in front of his and rolled, kicking him with everything I had in the knee. Nasty sounds happened in that knee and he went down. I kicked the knee again with my heel, and he was curled up in a ball. I made it to my feet, just in time to be caught from behind in a chokehold. Dad had demonstrated what I should do in that situation. Headbutt the guy in the face with the back of your head, as hard as you can. I went and did likewise, smiting them hip and thigh and two in the balls. The second thug I kicked in the balls crumpled. He was stronger than I thought, and as he went down, he got an elbow around my neck and took me down with him. I'm strong, too, though, and I headbutted him until I got a clear shot at his balls. I took it, and jumped free. I saw a half dozen guys come around the corner of the building, running full tilt for us. The cavalry. Stupidly, I waved and called to them instead of keeping my guard up. I felt a searing pain in my lower back and something crashed into the side of my head. Darkness filled my vision, and as they say, I took no further part in the proceedings. I didn't know what was happening to me. There were flashes of strobe-like intensity, like an old-fashioned film, starting and stopping. I had brief glimpses of a bank of lights over me and people in blue masks bending over me. I saw Dad and Mom, sitting in chairs across the room, Mom's face glittering with tears, Dad's arm around her. I even thought I saw Talbot, his face etched with concern, and imagined his lips on my forehead. The flashes began to last longer, and things finally began to swim back into focus. I tried to sit up, but some idiot had put a cloth belt across me. One of my arms was in a cast, and the other was strapped to the bed with a bunch of tubes running into it. I looked around as best I could. There was another bed in the room. It was occupied, but I couldn't make out who was in it. There were too many machines in the way, and the person appeared to have as many tubes and wires attached to them as I did. Mom was sitting in the chair I had the memory of from before. Her eyes were closed, and she looked drawn and worn. My beautiful little mother, sleeping in a chair in a hospital room, nearly made me cry. I tried to say something, but all that came out was a hoarse croak. Her eyes snapped open, and she leaped to her feet, hurrying to the side of my bed.
"Livingston, are you awake, sweetheart?"
she asked, concern written in her warm brown eyes. I croaked again. Well, this wasn't going as well as I'd hoped. My throat was as dry as a 1,000-year-old mummy.
"Drink,"
I managed to gasp. No, you can't drink, baby, she said. Here, suck on some of this ice.
She put a spoonful in my mouth from a styrofoam cup, and I melted it on my parched tongue. The blessed coolness drizzled down my throat and I opened my mouth for more. She shoveled it in like I was a baby bird and I finally got a little relief.
Mom, what happened? I asked. Where's Dad? Is Monica okay?
Yes, she's over there in the other bed. Mom nodded toward the festooned person.
Your father went to get something for us to eat and drink. He'll be back in a minute. How long have I been here?
I asked.
3 days, honey, she said. You talked to us a couple of times. What happened?
I asked her.
Why am I here? You were stabbed, Livingston, she said. You have a fractured skull and a broken arm. You're going to be okay, baby. You just need to get some rest and recover.
What about Monica? I asked.
She's going to be okay, too, Mom said. She just has some broken ribs, a concussion, and some bruises and scrapes. Did the police get the guys that did this? I asked.
Yes, baby, but don't worry about that, she said. That rude policeman has been here to see you several times. He's been talking to Monica. He's not as rude to her. I wanted to laugh, but I had a terrible headache.
He's rude to everyone, Mom, I told her. If he's rude to you, I'll punish him.
She gave a little chuckle.
He's a little afraid of your father.
He should be, I said.
Mom, I'm really, really sleepy now. Would you mind?
I faded to black. I slept for hours and days. Every time I woke up, I hurt, and the nurses would come and give me pain medication, which put me out again. I thought the cycle was never going to end. I don't know how many days that went on, but finally I woke up and, although I still hurt, I didn't want any more drugs. I opened my eyes after a bit, and Monica was sitting in the chair beside me.
Hey, Wonder Woman,
she said. Dad, I had to laugh a little at that.
Wonder Woman is a white girl with giant tits, I told her. I always picture myself as a Selena Kyle.
She raised one immaculate eyebrow. The scrape over it ruined the look.
Catwoman,
I said. She laughed.
Livingston, you can be any superheroine you want, she said.
You saved my life.
You'll always be my hero. You doing okay?
I asked.
I've been better, she said. I'm getting out of here tomorrow.
You're losing your roommate. You haven't exactly been a brilliant conversationalist, anyway.
She was funny. What are you going to do?
I asked.
I think they're going to make me disappear, she said. What about Talbot?
I asked.
Aren't you, don't you, he's in love with you.
She laughed.
What makes you think that?
Get real, I said.
I've seen the way he looks at you. He's crazy about you.
No, he's crazy about you. She looked a little wistful.
Why would he even look at me when he's got you?
I said.
I mean, look at you. You're the hottest, smartest, sweetest woman I've ever met. I'm about half in love with you, myself.
She laughed again.
Well, you should have seen him when we got to this room, she said. I was awake and I saw it. He made the nurses bring him down in a wheelchair. He didn't even look at me. He got up out of that wheelchair and held you in his arms and sobbed his heart out.
She smiled.
He just kept saying over and over again how sorry he was and that he's never going to let you go again. I practically had to scream at him to get him to even look at me. Then he just asked me all about what happened to you. I might as well have not been in the room.
I was stunned. I had been so sure they were in love and that I'd lost him.
Really?
My voice quavered quite a lot. I was not going to cry.
Really?
She said. A tear formed at the corners of those beautiful eyes.
I do love him, you know, she said. He loves one of us, but it's not me. I'll never stand in the way of the love he has for you. He loved me as a fill-in, when he couldn't get you. He's loved you from the first day you met. I owe you my life, Livingston. Are you going to throw him away?
I couldn't believe this woman. God, she made me feel like a wretch. I could feel my own eyes leaking.
No, Monica, I'm not. I don't know what to say. Do you know I think I love you?
Her breath caught in a sob and she was hugging me.
I love you too, she said, her cheek against mine. How could I not?
Monica. Monica, you're hurting my back. I hated to mention it, but it was excruciating. She sat on the edge of my bed and cupped my cheek in her hand.
You're amazing, she said, laughing. Here I am getting all mushy and your back is hurting. Yeah, well, getting stabbed in the back hasn't exactly been salubrious to my health, I said.
She gasped and I hurried to correct the misapprehension.
Not you, I said. Those assholes that were kidnapping you.
Oh, she said.
Those. The guys you saved me from.
I took her hand and pressed it against my cheek.
Monica, don't disappear, I told her. I need you. Stay here. You can stay with me. I'll hire 24-hour protection. All my life, I wanted a sister. My mother and father couldn't have children. That's why they adopted me. I always wanted them to adopt a sister for me, but they said I was enough for them. They wanted to lavish all their love on me. You could be my sister.
Tears were running down her cheeks again.
Livingston, there's nothing I'd like better, but I can't. Why not?
I asked.
Don't you see? She said. I need my own life, Livingston. I can't be just an extension of yours.
I'd see you and Talbot every day. I'd see how happy you were together, and my soul would die a little every time I saw that.
She's right, you know. I turned my head and Jopie was leaning against the door jamb. What do you know? I practically yelled at him. You're a man. You're a freaking policeman. You don't know shit.
I know she's right about this, he said, unperturbed at my emotion. Look, you're a hell of a tough, brave lady. I know that, you know that, and Monica knows that. You don't have to keep proving it to everyone.
I wanted to curse at him, spit at him. You don't know anything about me, I snarled.
Sure I do. His voice was gentle.
White roses, remember, Livingston? I blushed and opened and closed my mouth several times. Nothing came out.
I know how hard you try, he said. You'd kill yourself trying and you'd drive Talbot like a slave. No matter how hard you try, Monica would always feel like number two. She'd always be second fiddle. She's a hell of a woman, herself.
Livingston, she deserves to be someone's number one. I've arranged for her to go somewhere, start her life over again. You've got to let her go.
No, please, Monica.
I was begging, unashamed and without remorse.
Don't go. We can make it work.
She leaned down and kissed me, her lips soft against mine.
I'm sorry, Livingston.
I can't.
Maybe in another life.
Remember, don't sell yourself short.
You're gorgeous. You're the most beautiful person I've ever met on the inside, too. Take care of Talbot.
She left me, holding out my hand with my face wet with my tears, Jopie in her wake. I got a tissue off my bedside table, dried my tears and blew my nose. I had just discarded the tissue when another voice spoke.
Hello, Pincushion, he said. Been in any stabbings today?
I sniffed.
No, not yet.
Why?
Was there someone you wanted stabbed?
My knife is in my purse.
Where is my purse?
I started to cry again. He was beside me in a flash, pulling the pole with his fore on it behind him. His arms went under my head. He held it to his chest and whispered.
Don't cry, Livy. It's okay. I can't stand to see you cry. I've never seen you cry before.
I'm not crying, I said.
I sniffed.
Hand me a tissue, Talbot. He got me one, but his left hand cupping my bandaged head never moved. I took the tissue and dabbed at my eyes.
It's okay to cry sometimes, he said.
I've been crying too.
God, Livy, I thought I'd lost you and I never got a chance.
I never.
God, Livy, I love you so much and I thought you were going to die and I never get the chance to apologize and tell you I love you.
I dabbed at my eyes with the tissue.
Talbot, if you call me.
He cut me off.
Take that tissue away from your face and hold still.
I dropped my hands.
Why?
Because I'm going to kiss you now, Livy.
He did, and for the life of me, tied up to that bed like I was, I couldn't get away.
I bowed to the forces of the universe and kissed him back. It went on for a long, long time, but something was wrong.
Talbot?
I murmured against his lips. He pulled away a half an inch.
What?
He asked.
You're pulling the bandage off my head.
I told him. A horrified look swept over his features and he jerked away.
Damn. I'm so sorry, Livy.
I grabbed him by his right ear.
Talbot.
Sorry, Livingston.
If I don't tear off any bandages or hurt you, can I kiss you again?
No, I need to tell you something first, I said.
Sit down, Talbot.
He pulled the chair around and sat down where he could hold my hand.
Shoot,
he said.
Talbot, tell me why you've kept after me all these years.
He shrugged.
Easy, he said.
I've loved you since the day I met you. I looked into those big brown eyes.
Me too,
I said. A look of confusion passed over his face.
W.
What? He was stammering a little.
Do you remember that first day when I started school with you?
I began.
I walked into art class and the only empty seat was at your table. You stood up and hugged me and introduced yourself to me.
Do you remember?
How could I forget?
He asked.
You were the hottest girl I'd ever seen. That's the day I started falling in love with you.
I told him.
You hugged me every day, no matter how many times I threatened you or told you to stop.
He looked at me, dumbfounded.
That can't be right, he said. You hated me for years. I tried like hell to get you to like me, but everything I did just pissed you off. That's what I wanted you to think,
I said.
Talbot, you don't know me very well, because I never let you.
I was afraid.
You don't know what it was like for me.
My birth mother didn't want me. She gave me to an orphanage.
Talbot, I figured out some things recently.
The reason I thought I hated you was that I was afraid of you.
No, that's not right either.
I was afraid of me. I have issues. I've always had trouble letting people get close to me. I've always been afraid that if I let people get close, they'd figure out what it was that was wrong with me, what made my birth mother give me away.
I'm sorry, Talbot. It was never anything about you.
It was me. He looked at me for a long minute.
Livingston, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard, he said.
God damn. I can't imagine what it must have been like for you. I swear, that makes me love you more than ever. I just want to take that little girl in my arms and never let her go.
His eyes twinkled.
The big one too.
Can I kiss you now?
He did. He obviously wanted to go farther than that, and I wanted just as badly to let him, but we both had so many wires and tubes and bandages it wasn't practical. So we practiced up on our kissing. We became very good at it, if I do say so myself. I used to think that the world's fastest jungle telegraph and rumor mill was a girl's sleepover. I was wrong.
It's a hospital.
I was amazed how soon everyone from the stuffy pompous chief doctor down to the pimply-faced orderly knew that Talbot and I were in love. What's more, they all acted as if it was the best news they'd heard all month. It was beyond embarrassing. Talbot and I spent every moment we could together. We probably weren't supposed to, but the hospital staff seemed to turn a blind eye to us whenever we needed it. If I had to put up with a few knowing winks and smiles in return, hey, it was worth it. Jopie visited me every day and kept me abreast of the case. The federal prosecutor was handing down indictments right and left. I guess he liked our Christmas present. There was 24-hour protection on the hospital, even though Monica was gone and my name had been kept very quiet. I kept trying to get him to tell me where Monica was, and all he would do was look worried. Finally, one day he put his head down close to my ear and told me, "A guy who owes me some favors has been keeping an eye on LNR for me. He says there's some out-of-towners around there who've been asking some questions about how the feds got all that accounting stuff. They don't care about saving Silvio's ass, but they're very interested in making sure it doesn't go any farther. They might trace it back to her, they might not, but since she was discharged from here, she might attract their attention, and they might come after her. What's she in? Some sort of witness protection program?" I was frantic. If that was true, I had lost her forever. "No, no, Livingston, nothing that bad. We just needed to get her out of sight for a while, until she falls off their radar." "We? So you do know where she is?" "Sort of. I know the first couple of stops on her way, anyway, and I heard yesterday she was safe. That's all I can tell you except she loves you." He touched my shoulder gently as he said it. "Will I see her again?" I would not let him see me cry. "Here?" "I doubt it. Maybe someday, after they're convinced neither of you is a threat, it will be safe for you to know where she is." We shared a hug, and he left. I suddenly noticed that he wasn't calling me Brooks anymore. I was Livingston now. Maybe Jopie's hard shell was opening a little, just as mine was. Talbot was visiting me the next day when Jopie came by. Okay, so we were practicing kissing again and had barely gotten ourselves disentangled when he entered the room. Jopie was actually smiling, looking like a man without a care in the world who had just bowled a 300 game. All Polish cops bowl, right? I barely recognized him. It turned out poor old Silvio and a couple of his chief lieutenants had been unable to make bail. His bosses had cut off his money, and he was inside for the duration. They were doing to him exactly what he'd done to Bandini. "Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, Mr. Pszibilowicz," Talbot said, rolling it off his tongue as if he was half Polish himself. I rolled my eyes at him in disgust. "Nice try, McCoy, but it's Jopie to you."
"Ha!" Huh?
I stuck my tongue out at Talbot.
"What do you mean, ha?" Huh?
"You're McCoy. I'm Livingston. And he never calls me Livy Dot." I smiled at Jopie, who turned a gratifying shade of red, then I changed the subject. "What do you suppose our friend Bandini thinks about all this?" We discussed that for a while. Jopie still looked like the cat who ate the canary. He was just leaving when Mom and Dad came in. He walked right up to Mom.
"Mrs. Brooks, I owe you an apology."
Mom's eyes widened a little. "I know I was rude to pretty much everyone here, and I'm sorry. I was afraid that Silvio might find a hole in our precautions and get to Livingston, and well." His smile faded and he stared at the floor. "I was worried, and when I'm worried I'm rude. Ruder than normal. She can tell you." He waved a hand in my direction and fell silent. His ears were bright red and the flush extended halfway up his bare scalp. Mom, as always, knew exactly what was going on. She smiled graciously at him.
"Of course I understand, and I accept your apology. Thank you for looking out for my Livingston."
She offered her hand to shake, then took Jopie's right hand in both of hers, and used it to pull him into a gentle hug. He turned even redder. I heard Talbot start to chuckle and I didn't dare look at him, or I'd have burst out laughing. That would not have been good for my stitches. Jopie extricated himself and recovered some of his dignity by going over to Dad.
"Good to see you again, Coach."
They shook hands and Jopie left the room. I didn't know it then, but it would be years before I saw Jopie again.
"Coach? What was that all about?"
I asked. Dad chuckled. "Joe played for St. Thaddeus back when they had a football team. They were all like him, all the heart you could ask for, never give up for anything, and no size or speed whatsoever. We trounced them every year, but we respected them in the morning. I guess he hasn't changed much." Finally, about a week later, Talbot and I were both down to just IVs. Mom and Dad had just left, and I was sitting up in bed, drinking one of those stupid white sodas they insisted on giving me when Talbot came in, dragging his four pole.
"Hey, sexy," he said. I snorted.
"Yeah, right. No makeup, my hair is a mess, and this gown has got to go, Talbot. I'm getting tired of showing my ass. I told Mom to bring some real pajamas tomorrow." "How come you get pajamas and I don't?" He laughed.
"I bribed the nurses," he said. "I like you showing your ass. It's the most fantastic ass I've ever seen. Livingston, you don't need makeup and your hair looks as beautiful and messy as it always does."
He came over and lowered the rail on my bed, took my Sprite out of my hand and sat on my bed. He was looking at me oddly and it was making me nervous. He scooted over a little and swung his legs up on my bed.
Talbot, what are you doing?"
I asked.
"I'm getting ready to kiss you," he said.
Well, that was okay, I guess. He put his arm around me and pulled me up against him. That kiss was a scorcher, and it just went on and on. I could feel his free hand as it moved down to my knee, slowly stroking up until he pushed the stupid hospital gown up to my thighs. I felt him pull the tie around my neck and it fell away, exposing my breasts. For some reason, my nipples were throbbing and as hard as nails.
"Talbot," I whispered, "someone is going to come in here, and this is going to be really embarrassing.
he laughed.
You have a very low opinion of my bribery skills.
He said. He kissed me again, and I felt his hand sliding up over my belly until it cupped one breast. I moaned into his mouth. He left my lips and kissed his way down my neck until he could capture one nipple. I felt my pussy flood and he had me moaning and writhing under him.
God, you're beautiful, Livy,
he murmured. I've wanted to taste one of these little chocolate kisses again for 11 years.
God, you have the most beautiful breasts.
They aren't huge, but they do sit up nice and high and firm. I wanted him to stop talking and love them some more, so I slid my hand into his pajamas.
Oh, that was very nice.
There was something big and hot and soft slash hard in there.
I'd had no idea.
I wanted to see it, but he was sliding my gown down, his hand moving down to cup between my legs. I felt one big finger part my lips and sample the moisture leaking out of me. He used it to coat my clit and tease me until I was trembling and wild.
Talbot. I want. I need.
I groaned. He slid over me and I reached down to position him. He slid into me and I groaned again as he stretched me, filling me up with that incredible cock. God, it felt good. It had been a long time for me. I tried to bring my hand up from between us, but something was wrong. Talbot winced, and I felt something pulling on my hand. I glanced down and my fore tube was under his balls, pulling them up as I tried to raise my hand. He looked down and we both collapsed, laughing. That kind of threw off our groove, but we got going again. I'm not at all promiscuous. Talbot was the fifth time I'd had sex, and he was driving me wild. It was sweet and slow, lots of kisses and whispers, and he must have told me.
I love you, Livy.
1,000 times.
I'm never letting you go.
He breathed in my ear. I had never felt so secure and loved in my life. I was in the arms of the man I had loved nearly all my adult life. I had been brought back from purgatory, and this was paradise. I was never going to let him go, either. I knew what I wanted. I wanted Talbot McCoy. I could feel the tension starting to build, and I was going to have a huge orgasm. I worried about tearing the staples out in my back, and that broke my concentration enough that I became aware of an annoying beeping sound. I tried to ignore it, and I pulled Talbot into me. The mood was slipping away, eroded by that infernal beeping as I pumped against him frantically. I came and it was sweet and the most romantic thing ever, but not that explosion I had felt building. Talbot came and I could feel him pumping into me, filling me with his warmth and love. He kissed me passionately and we looked in each other's eyes. The beeping sound intruded. I looked at him and we burst out laughing.
Is that you or me?
I gasped.
One of us has a kink in our fore or something.
We laughed for about 5 minutes.
Well, it's not the romantic jazz I would have planned for our first time,
he said. Somehow, the sound of heavy machinery backing up just doesn't set the tone for me.
God, I love you, Livy. There's no one else in the world that would laugh with me about something like that at that particular time.
I frowned at him.
Talbot.
He kissed me.
Sorry, Livingston. I do love you, though. When we get out of here, yeah.
I said. I'm going to be ready for that soft jazz.
Wine and candles, Talbot. I want to be romanced.
Well, maybe we should call a nurse, he suggested. He pushed the call button. I was horrified and began to wiggle frantically, trying to get him off me so I could tie my gown. He weighed a ton, and he just kept me pinned. I snatched the covers over us as I heard the door open. Our nurse burst out laughing when she saw us. Was my face ever red? Well, sort of a brownish pink, actually. But you know what I mean. I was the one beeping. The unfortunate scrotum lassoing incident had caused a kink in my line, and she quickly got it sorted out. I gave him a good pummeling once she left.
If you ever do anything like that again,
I threatened. He didn't seem in the least intimidated. He was going to learn. Talbot seemed a little down when he came to visit me the next day.
They're going to send me home tomorrow,
he said.
What's the matter with that? Don't you want to get out of here? You won't be just down the hall anymore. I can't just think, oh, I want a kiss from Livingston and come down here and get one. What am I going to do?
Poor man, he really did look woebegone.
Well, until last week, you went without for about 9 years, and it didn't seem to bother you. That's how much you know. Well then, you'd better just get that face of yours over here and start stocking up on kisses.
He did. I thought he was trying to wear my lips off. God, that man can kiss. I was released a couple of days after Talbot. He came with Mom and Dad to take me home. My little apartment had never looked so good to me. I was supposed to take it easy and not go back to work for a week. Talbot had to go back to the PD's office the day after I was discharged, so I had a lot of time to myself. As I've said before, I'm not a very introspective person, but those days I was home by myself, I couldn't help it. I mused about how I'd changed.
Oh, you'd still recognize me, fiery, competitive, in your face, kick your ass if I have to, remember my name, Livingston Brooks.
It seemed that the hard shell I'd used to fend people off and protect the scared little girl was showing some cracks. It had to be some sort of cosmic justice, or maybe a cosmic joke. I'd always hated blondes and cops. Now, of course, the closest people in my life except for Mom, Dad, and Talbot, were a blonde and a cop. I wanted to make a name for myself as a defense attorney. The biggest triumph of my career so far was a prosecution for which somebody else would get the credit. Worst of all, I was head over heels in love with the guy I'd done my best to hate for 12 years. I mean, somebody up there must be laughing their ass off over all this. After I thought about it for a minute, though, I had to laugh, too. I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. I'd always been happy with Mom and Dad, of course. Now I had Talbot, too, and Monica and even Jopie. I was sure we'd be together again, sooner or later,
You can't break up the Three Musketeers that easily. Even if nobody else ever knew, I knew. I had used my talents and skills to help bring down the worst kind of scumbag out there, someone who hurt people for profit. That scared little girl could rest now, safe and sound, loved and wanted and secure forever. She smiled. The entire staff of Goldblum, Perry, and Tate, right down to the janitor, was there to welcome me on my first day back. It wasn't exactly rockstar treatment, it was more personal, somehow, but it was definitely noisy. I remembered Mr. Tate saying that everyone there liked me and wished me well. It seemed like he was right. Speaking of whom, there he was, beaming at me from the edge of the crowd, signaling that he wanted to see me in his office. I looked at the people hemming me in and shrugged my shoulders. He laughed and mouthed, later, at me. It's a good thing I'm not short, I never would have seen him. It was after 11 when I finally got to Mr. Tate's office. He stood and seated me, then closed his office door. He looked at me closely.
Welcome back, he said. I'm glad to see you show no ill effects from your secondment.
His eyes twinkled at me.
Thank you, sir. I'm completely healthy and ready for anything.
His smile faded.
Anything is a big word, Livingston. I'm not sure any of us can say that.
He paused.
However, that's a later discussion.
There's something I need to show you first. Come around where you can see it.
I walked around to his side of the desk and looked at his monitor to see what he wanted me to see. It was a picture of Jopie and Monica. They didn't look intimate, but they were clearly happy and comfortable together, in spite of the fact that she was a good 3 inches taller than him. Jopie still had the relaxed, almost carefree look he'd had the last time I'd seen him.
Well, of all the...
I didn't know just what to say. Mr. Tate laughed.
No, I didn't expect it either. It seems Joseph's bosses thought he had done such a good job that he, too, should be sent away and kept out of sight. Someone needed to keep an eye on Monica. They'd gotten acquainted while you both were in the hospital, and there you have it.
Mr. Tate smiled and motioned me back to my chair.
Livingston, you probably know my old friend Joseph is not an easy man to impress. He's no fan of attorneys either. I'm afraid we all have me to thank for that.
He looked away from me sadly for a moment.
Anyway, you should know that a couple of days after you were, hospitalized, he came in here raving about how smart and brave and strong you were, and if I let anything happen to you he'd deal with me personally. Then he got nose to nose with me and said you were worth more than any 3 other lawyers he'd ever met. Including, especially, me.
Of course, I was elated over the praise from Jopie. He certainly didn't hand out compliments lightly. I wasn't so sure about his telling my senior partner I was worth more than he was.
Mr. Tate sighed and continued. You see, back in high school, Joseph and I were best friends, and we knew exactly what we were going to do. He would be the cop, I would be the prosecutor, and together we would clean out the baddies and make the place safe for moms and little kids. Sort of like Law and Order, I guess. That's how we started out, too. Then, after a couple of years, we discovered the worst bad guy we had brought down was a third offense drunk driver. I couldn't handle it, Livingston. I was going nowhere, I needed more money for my family, and the wicked were flourishing more than ever. I left the DA's office and joined Goldblum and Perry, and never looked back. Joseph called on me once, and told me what he thought of me. Ichabod, he called me. As you know, unlike me, he stuck it out.
I thought about Jopie. His best friend gave up the fight, then he lost his wife. No wonder he had that hard shell. I thought of our kiss. I was gladder than ever that I'd given it to him.
She deserves to be someone's number one, he'd said of Monica.
Well, so did he. Dad's words in the hospital room came back to me.
All the heart you could ask for, and wouldn't quit for anything.
Mr. Tate looked at me oddly. I hadn't realized I'd spoken the words aloud.
Sorry. My dad coached against his football team, and that's what he said about Jopie. Joseph, that is.
Mr. Tate nodded.
Yes, that's Joseph, all right. You see, what he was really telling me was that you are the lawyer he had hoped I would be.
I think he's right. Now I was completely confused. Livingston Brooks, crime-fighting DA? Not in a million years. Or was I already halfway there? Mr. Tate came back to the present.
I know your specialty is defense, Livingston, and you're very good at it. You're also all the things Joseph said you were. We want you here in the firm for the rest of your career. Now that you're back, I'll be meeting with the other partners to decide on an offer to you that we hope you'll find attractive. Meanwhile, if it's acceptable to you, you will report directly to me.
His eye twinkled as he said it. It took a moment for me to remember that everyone who reported to Mr. Tate was a partner. I grinned at him.
I take it we can regard that as settled then?
Yes, sir. I said it with enthusiasm.
Very well then. Your secondment to the public defender's office is terminated effective immediately.
What?
After all of this, he was taking Bandini away from me?
How could he? You needn't worry about Mr. Bandini. The firm will defend him. I am taking the case.
He looked at me as if I should read more into what he said. After a moment, I got it. I mentally took off my hat to my friend Jopie. You know the scene at the end of Casablanca, where Laszlo tells Rick,
"Welcome back to the fight. This time, our side will win."
That's what it was like. I stood up. Mr. Tate stood up. We shook hands.
Jopie told me he had someone keeping an eye on LNR. I wouldn't happen to know that someone, would I?
I kept my voice low, as Jopie taught me. My new boss just met my eye, and shrugged out I'd been back at work a couple of months. Talbot was going to propose that night.
How did I know?
Unlike me, he's completely straightforward and uncomplicated, and he can't keep a secret for anything.
When we have kids, I'll have to do all the Christmas presents myself, because sure as a gun's iron, he'll spill the beans. I love him just as he is, and I'm sure I have enough complications for both of us. Anyway, I thought this would be the night for a certain little white dress I'd been saving up for just such an occasion. It and Slutty weren't in the same area code, but he wouldn't have to look twice to know what I had for him. It was exactly what I wanted. I opened to Talbot's knock on my door, and smiled innocently at him as he gaped, goggled, stuttered, and all but drooled, all in a most gratifying way. I lifted his chin back into place with my finger, let him show me to his MG, then turned him to stone again as I got in and seated myself. Short skirt, low slum car, and long legs, yes, I was taking advantage, but just ask him if he didn't love it. He took me to this barbecue place. It had a huge open fire pit right down the middle that they cooked on. Their meats were as good as any I've had, and their sauces were to die for. They had them from every region, Kansas City, North Carolina, Georgia, all over. Fortunately for my white dress, they also had oversized thick cloth napkins. Talbot and I are both hearty meat eaters, and I tied one of those napkins around my neck and we set to. We had nothing but bones in front of us and had just ordered dessert. It was time. He cleared his throat, whipped off his napkin, and knelt by my chair. People nearby were starting to notice, and nudge their neighbors and point. Suddenly, a horrendously loud bell started clanging. It sounded like one of those old-fashioned fire alarms. At first, I thought Talbot had set it up to make it memorable, but that didn't make sense. He wouldn't have been able to keep the secret. Besides, he was looking just as confused as everyone else was. "I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but the fire has jumped the pit and we must evacuate." Our waiter was trying to shoo us out. I looked back and sure enough, one of the wooden decks next to the fire pit had caught fire. The cooks were setting up hoses while the waiters moved people toward the exits. They all looked as if they'd done it before, and it was no big deal. We joined the mass exodus and headed for the car. We sat in Talbot's MG and looked at each other, and suddenly started laughing. We laughed until we cried. Then Talbot pointed to the big white napkin that was still tied around my neck, and I used it to wipe the streak of barbecue sauce off his face, and we laughed some more. I guess people might have thought we were crazy. I didn't care. My man and I were together. Nothing else mattered. When I could stop laughing, I leaned over the stick shift, took his head between my hands, and gave him the works.
"What was that for, Livingston?"
There was still sort of a pause after the live, but he was trying. I just smiled at him. He got it. He smiled back at me, and drove us to my apartment. The little white dress didn't see a dance floor that night. That was okay, there would be other nights. Besides, the one person I was wearing it for had already appreciated it. I was ready for him to appreciate something else, now that we washed up. I put the white napkin away carefully. I wanted it to show my grandchildren. Then Talbot McCoy knelt on the floor of my living room, produced a beautiful ring from his pocket, and asked me to marry him. I had toyed with the idea of teasing him, but looking into those big brown eyes, I just couldn't. I simply said,
"Yes."
He put the ring on my finger, and then swept me up in his arms. He held me like a baby as the kiss went on, and on dot my eyes were heavy with lust, my nipples were aching and my panties were soaked.
"I'm not sure I can walk," I told Talbot.
"Where do you want to be?"
he asked.
"Bedroom,"
I said. He carried me in and stood me up at the foot of the bed.
"Wait right here,"
I told him. He sat on the end of the bed and I went into my closet, selecting what I was looking for out of a box on my top shelf. I carried it into the bathroom, concealing it from him. I stripped and put on the things from the box, looking at myself in the mirror. I thought he would like it. It was a satin and lace teddy, red, with a pair of matching red satin panties. The lace of the teddy cupped my breasts, a small thickening of the lace barely concealing my nipples. They engorged even more as I looked in the mirror. I thought he would enjoy this very much. I opened the door quietly, leaning against the doorjamb, hip shot and one arm bent over my head, half concealed in my hair. Talbot was looking at a small picture album off the nightstand by the bed. I cleared my throat softly and he looked up. His mouth opened and he croaked out some unintelligible sound. He licked his lips and tried again.
"My God, Livingston, you look. Come here, you twilight goddess."
He didn't wait, but met me about halfway across the room. He held me at arm's length and just looked at me.
"You are a goddess,"
he breathed. I slowly raised my hands until they were cupping my breasts.
"Are you just going to look, or do you want to taste?"
I asked him.
"Oh, I want to taste, all right,"
he said. He raised my arms, turned my hands palms up, and made a show of examining them.
Talbot,
I said.
"Just checking to make sure you aren't going to rope my nuts,"
he said. By the time we finished laughing, we had both collapsed on the bed, wiping the tears from our eyes. He rolled over, half on top of me, and he was deadly serious.
"Livingston, I'll never be able to tell you how much I love you and how happy you've made me,"
he said. My heart was a big gooey mass.
"Show me,"
I whispered. He leaned in and kissed me, his lips moving against mine, soft, and then firmer as they insisted on my response. My heart was open and I knew that this was my man, and I would never let him go. That scared little girl inside me was enfolded in love and I belonged to Talbot. I opened up, he came in and I knew my life was never going to be the same. That shell vanished in a puff of smoke and there was only Talbot and Livingston. My fingers fumbled at the buttons of his shirt, and he helped me, shedding clothes until there was nothing between us but the lace and satin of my teddy. I was trembling, on the verge of crying, I was so overwhelmed by my emotion. His lips left mine and he kissed and nibbled down my neck, nibbling at my earlobes until I shivered and goosebumps covered me. He pushed back my mop of hair to gain better access, and his lips on my neck were driving me wild. I had never felt so alive, and he was claiming me, inch by slow inch. I belonged to him, and he belonged to me. When his lips reached the lace covering my breasts, he continued to nuzzle me and took one nipple between his lips, using his teeth inside to squeeze it gently, and then more firmly. "Take it off," I whispered. He nuzzled his way down the satin to the lace border, tickled my navel with his tongue, making me shiver again, and pushed the teddy up with his nose, his lips tracing a line of fire up my belly. I arched my back and he used his hands to push the back up. It hung for a moment at the stiffness of my nipples and then he was pushing it off and up over my head. His eyes never left my face and as he moved back down I felt myself begin to tremble, waiting for the explosion of sensation when he reached my nipples. I was on fire with an agony of anticipation and he nibbled and kissed all around my nipples. I could feel my areola crinkle and I was going crazy. He continued to tease me until I tangled my fingers in his perfect hair and thrust at him with my nipple. I was groaning with arousal and frustration. When his lips closed around my little bullet I felt it, swelling inside me, as he tugged with his lips and laved it with his tongue. This was what I'd been waiting for all my life, this moment, this man, and I was where I belong. When he kissed his way to its twin and scraped it with his teeth, I came, pulling his head close and moaning out my pleasure. He sucked it in and tremors exploded through me. "Talbot, oh God, Talbot!" I cried. "Jesus, baby, oh my God!" As the explosion passed, he continued to love my breasts, and I ran my hands up and down his back. I pushed against him. "Let me!" I gasped. He let me push him over and I repeated his journey, paying as much attention to his nipples as he did mine. He was smooth and powerful beneath my lips and fingers and I kissed my way down to his boxers, tugging at them until he raised his hips and let me pull them off. That beautiful cock sprang free and I captured it with my hand. He was uncircumcised, the first of those I'd ever had. I never really got a chance to get too personal in the hospital but I was going to now. It was as hard as iron, but strangely soft at the same time. I pulled back his foreskin and gave the head a swipe with my tongue. He jumped, and I giggled before swooping down to take him in my mouth. He groaned as my lips slid down. There was no way I was going to be able to take all of that. Maybe someday, with a lot of practice. I planned to get a lot of practice. I loved that cock. It was mine and I was establishing my claim. I was a little tentative at first, but I quickly found out that he liked me running my tongue around the head while sucking up and down that fat shaft. "Livingston. God, I'm not going to last. I'm going to come, Livy!" That was exactly what I wanted. I felt the head swell and the heavy sack tighten under my fingers. He groaned and I felt the heavy vein along the underside pulse. His hot milky cum spurted into my mouth and I tried to swallow it all. There was no way I could keep up. I looked up at his face as I did my best, and the look was indescribable. I couldn't believe the rush of power and emotion that swept over me. I nearly came again as I watched him, groaning out his pleasure, as he emptied himself. I kept swiping the head with my tongue, sucking away like a baby until he pulled at my arms.
"Stop, Livingston! Too sensitive!"
he gasped. He pulled me up beside him and I lay my head on his chest, listening to his heart pounding. After a half a minute or so, he pulled me up and on top of him. He kissed me all over my face, even as I struggled to pull away.
"No, Talbot," I protested. "I'm messy. You're my messy little dusky queen and I get to kiss you anytime I want to,"
he growled. I guess if he didn't mind, I didn't. He rolled us over and looked into my eyes.
"My turn,"
he said. He began that trail of fire down my body again until he was prone on his belly between my thighs.
"So beautiful," he murmured. "I've been waiting for years for this moment."
I was beside myself. I could feel his hot breath on my bare mound. He nipped at the thin strip of black curls above and then bit me on the inner thigh, letting me gently feel his teeth. I started and then moaned as he placed a kiss right in the center of my pussy. I felt his tongue tickling my labia and then he was running it up one side to the hard little nub of my clitoris, and then repeating with the other side. I could feel my thighs begin to tremble as he worked on me like I was a fine instrument, and he was the master, bringing me higher and higher, strings quivering in harmony with his movements. His thumb and forefinger pulled back the hood of my clit, and it felt half an inch long as he teased it with the tip of his tongue. I cried out, thrusting myself forward, seeking more contact. When his lips closed around my button and his tongue lashed against it, I exploded off the bed, coming more powerfully than anything I'd ever experienced. I felt a finger penetrate me, and just as I began to relax from that giant orgasm, he curled his finger up inside me, finding a magic place that I never knew existed and sending me into orbit again. The pleasure was excruciating and every muscle in my body contracted as I felt my nectar flood over his hand. I gasped and shuddered my way over the crest, and his tongue on my clit grew almost painful. It was my turn to protest and pull him up.
"No, Talbot, I can't."
He let me pull him up and I threw my arms around that powerful body, clinging to him and weeping out my love for him.
"I love you, Talbot," I sobbed. "God, I love you. Please don't ever leave me."
He silenced me with a kiss.
"Never going to let you go," he said. "Never."
I could feel his throbbing maleness against my dripping opening and I pulled on his butt, desperate to draw him in, to have him claim me with that beautiful cock.
"Love me, Talbot," I whispered. "Make love to me."
I felt the head slip between my lips and he sank deep inside me, stretching me wonderfully. He drew back a little and then that beautiful fullness was back.
I felt his balls pressing against my cheeks and he was inside, sheathed in me, and it was the most incredible feeling on earth. The man I loved was in me, part of me, and I could feel his love for me in every pore of my body. He moved, slowly and gently, allowing me to adjust to his size, and I could feel the head of that amazing shaft touch gently against the back of my pussy on every exquisite stroke.
"You're mine, Livingston," he whispered. "Don't you ever forget."
He increased the length of his plunges into my depths, but kept the same slow, sweet rhythm. It felt like hours that he was inside me, building a slow fire that was consuming us both. It crested in small orgasms for me, building into something I knew was going to be life-changing, shattering, and as I finally crested and the wave swept me away, I heard myself calling his name, as if from far away, and his answering shout of completion as I came with an overwhelming power that I felt him pumping into me, the scalding pleasure of the man I loved filling me as I was meant to be filled, destined to be filled. He slowed to a stop, the ripples of aftershocks shaking me as my pussy continued to spasm around the shaft filling me. His great weight, on me and in me, filled me with a sense of love and security that I'd never known. When we caught our breath enough to kiss, it was the sweetest, most fulfilling moment of my life. He rolled off me, pulling me with him until he slipped out, leaving me empty and longing for the next time I would be filled. My cheek rested on his chest, and I again heard the hammering of his heart.
"Livingston," he murmured.
"Hmm?" I couldn't muster the energy for words.
"Remember when you told me I was too perfect?"
he asked. I nodded on his chest.
"Well, if you were more perfect, if this moment was more perfect, I would just die right here,"
he said. I murmured my agreement. Not about my perfection, I knew how far I had to go, but about the perfection of the moment. We drifted off into the best sleep of my life. I knew in the morning, he would be there. We would make slow, sweet love, and I was going to call in and skip work. I was in love, and I doubted I'd ever get out of bed again, as long as Talbot McCoy was in it. I was as big as a house. Bigger. I was sure I was the biggest pregnant woman in the history of the world. Mom just laughed at me, and the doctor insisted I was perfectly normal.
Talbot?
He insisted on calling me sexy and beautiful and kissing me all over, and I do mean all over. He even had the nerve to say I got more beautiful every day. He was infuriating, and I still had 3 weeks to go. I was leaning back in the recliner in the living room and Talbot brought in the mail. He had tossed most of the junk when he opened a small envelope.
"What the?"
He handed it me a small card. It had a single white rose on the front. I opened it, and there was some kind of writing on the inside. I thought I remembered seeing something like it before, but I couldn't remember where. Then I thought of the white rose, and it clicked.
"Talbot, I need you to take me somewhere. Is this another one of m'lady's whims of expectancy? What if it is? You know you're going to do what I want anyway."
I smirked at him. He heaved an exaggerated sigh, and then our eyes met. We smiled a lover's smile. We went in the side door of the old Russian Orthodox church. I showed Talbot an icon. He recognized that the writing on it matched the writing on the card.
"But how sure?" I said. "We're in church. I'll explain later."
The old priest was surprised when he opened the little card, but gladly translated for us.
"Blessings be upon you, and your baby. We will meet again. Love always, Monica and Joseph."
Do you believe in love at first sight? I do. I fell in love with Talbot McCoy the moment I laid eyes on him. Looking down at that little dusky bundle of love in my arms, I knew my life was never going to be the same. Love at first sight, yeah, I'm a believer.
"What's her name?"
the nurse asked.
"Anderson,"
Talbot said.
"Her name is Anderson."
He tickled her under the chin.
"Hi, Andy,"
he cooed.
"God, she's beautiful. She looks just like you, Livy. Talbot."
The end. You have been listening to this podcast on the Erotica Podcast Network. Please visit our other podcasts. Their links are in the description of this episode. The Erotica Podcast and the Erotica Taboo Podcast offer $2 subscriptions, which opens up bonus content.